want to get started? Just grab a seat at any place you want. Let me get going here. You know, it's really gratifying to see such a sizable number of malcontents coming out on the afternoon. It's so cold and nasty out, and that's good. That's a good sign.
The same thing happens during Bears games.
Yeah. Anyway, my name is Robert Hughes with Open University of Left. I'd like to welcome everybody here this afternoon, taking time away from your busy schedules, I'm sure, but hopefully this will be an educational experience for all of us. We're going to learn something here. If not, maybe we'll have something to convey ourselves. Anyway, what I want to do is, before we get directly to our guests here, go over our upcoming event schedule. I actually pass these things out going back. Does everybody have one? Or if you don't, you get one in your hands. This is what's going forward. We're going to be here on Thursday night. That's this Thursday, February 15th at 7 o'clock. We're going to have Steve Masek, media studies professor from North Central College and Chicago Media Action member. He's going to make a presentation on the demonization of the inner city and contemporary mass media, culture, and politics. He further analyzes the right wing's exploitation of popular fears about the city. And he is the author of Urban Nightmares, The Media, the Right, and the Moral Panic Over the City. This title is a winner of the 2006 Urban Communication Foundation Publication Awards. So that's going to be on Thursday night at 7 o'clock in this room. Everything is in this room. Following that, on Saturday, March 3rd, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you notice if it's a Saturday event, it's in the afternoon. If it's a Thursday night or a Tuesday night, it's usually around 7 o'clock. On Saturday, March 3rd, we welcome activist organizer John Beecham from Chicago ANSWER. ANSWER, of course, an acronym for Act Now to Stop the War and End Racism. He's going to make a presentation on the need for building a mass movement to end the war. On March 17th, International ANSWER will lead a march on the Pentagon in D.C. This is historically significant in that this year marks the 40th anniversary. For those, I see a few faces here that look like they might have been around at that time. That marks the 40th anniversary of the first Pentagon march, going back now to the Vietnam era, of course, in 1967. The message from that anti-war march was from protest to resistance. So things really ratcheted up as a consequence of that event. And of course, it marked a turning point in the development of a nationwide anti-war movement at that time. So we'll only have to see what this portends for our current situation. Moving on, Thursday, March 8th at 7 o'clock, OUL welcomes, we have Joan Brunwasser. She's election reform advocate and voting integrity editor of the progressive website Op-Ed News. She's going to speak on the making of an activist, essentially how ordinary citizens can effectively bring their causes into the public arena. And she's going to be joined on that evening by a Tribune journalist, Robert Kohler. And I'm not quite sure exactly how that's going to dovetail in there, but we'll see. Moving on, Saturday, March 31st at 2 o'clock, another afternoon event on a Saturday. This is a big one. We have author, activist, poet, and correspondent John Ross. Ross was raised in New York's Greenwich Village and has lived for years in Mexico City's Old Quarter. You might know him as a frequent contributor to Counterpunch, also written for The Nation, Z Magazine, and the Mexican daily La Jornada. He's written several books, both fictional as well as nonfiction. In addition, he has written three books specifically chronicling the Zapatista movement in Mexico. He is going to make a presentation on that day based on his most recently completed book, which I don't believe is available yet. It's entitled Making Another World Possible, Zapatista Chronicles 2000 to 2006, which my understanding is to be published by Nation Books. So that's basically our schedule going forward now for the next month, or actually 2 months. And I think without further ado, to introduce our guest today, I'm going to turn it over to Hugh Iglarsh. Take it away, Hugh.
Thanks everyone for coming. It's the first debate we've done here at OUL in some time, and it looks like we should schedule more of these in the future. And my thanks to the participants for being willing to come here today and to respond to each other's positions. It should be a very interesting event. Let me see. Opening the event will be Vishal Shichapainchik, who has spoken previously at OUL on media questions. Today he'll be talking about participatory economics, presenting his position on basically a post-capitalist or non-capitalist alternative way of organizing the economy and society. Let me see, he's a member of the Chicago Area Participatory Economic Society, CAPES, as I understand it, he will explain it better, but it's a way of making democratic decision-making replace the market mechanism. Let me see, and afterwards, David Schweikart will be speaking. He's a professor of philosophy at Loyola University. Among his many impressive academic credentials, he has, I think, two different PhDs, right, in philosophy and mathematics. He's also a longtime activist. His model is what he calls economic democracy, correct me if I'm wrong, which is essentially a form of market socialism. So each of the speakers will have a chance to present their own positions, and then we will immediately cut to the floor for an open discussion, which should be lively. A couple of other logistical things: we'll be passing around a bucket. We do pay rent on this space, although not a very steep rent, and we do have some costs. So we ask for a $5 donation. Whatever you can afford is great. And we will also be passing around a sign-up sheet to get your email addresses. It looks like there are a lot of new faces here. So if you're not already receiving our announcements, please add your name. And all right, take away Mitchell.
Okay, thank you, Hugh. This is a presentation I'm going to give. Last about 30 minutes. We timed it earlier this week at about 26 minutes, so in that ballpark. And then David will give a presentation of about 30 minutes as well, and then we throw it out to all of you. The presentation I'm going to give today is a discussion of an exposition on a model of economics that was first published in 1991 in two books that were published more or less simultaneously by two gentlemen. One, Michael Albert, whom a lot of people know from his work with Z Magazine and ZNet, as well as Robin Hanel, who is on the faculty of American University at Washington, D.C. In 1991, they co-presented a brand new model of economics that they term par econ, or participatory economics. That's what I'm going to talk about in this talk. It'll basically, the talk will be structured by basically more or less three parts. One is, what do we deem as a success in terms of an economy? We can do this by, describe this in a number of different metaphors, like a compass, or a scorecard if you're scoring more or less. It's basically a rough measure of success. And par econ terms this as its values. What do we deem as the values for a successful economy, besides the usual production, consumption, and allocation that any economy is going to have to do? It will almost inevitably do more than that. There are seats up here in the front if you wanted to join in. What are the values? That's going to be the first thing, and we'll sketch that out. And then the thing is that basically the institutions, as par econ terms it, which are basically the way in which the rules of the game for the scorecard, or the path that you take that a compass leads you on. It's basically how is the economy structured in more or less sketch outline to help to try to achieve those values. That's part two of this talk. And then part three is, does those institutions try to fill those values that we outlined at the beginning? And that's basically going to be the three parts of my talk. But before I actually delve into that, I'd actually start off with a little personal story of my own. And this kind of connects into the talk that I had actually given almost a year ago at OUL, where I helped, with two colleagues of mine in the group I'm involved with called Chicago Media Action. It was through work in the media activism sphere that got me interested in the realm of theoretical economics. And just a quick anecdotal story. About 5 years ago, I was doing some tabling in Evanston, and I was giving talking at the time to help to raise awareness about what the Federal Communications Commission was going to do with their then controversial series of media ownership rules. The idea being that the FCC was going to allow it so that fewer and fewer companies could own more and more media properties, and as a result make the media basically lousier across the board as a result. And so I was involved in this tabling about bringing efforts to try to raise awareness about this, and in so doing help to try to stop it. And then one gentleman came up to me in the course of discussing this, and he basically said, okay, so suppose you achieve this. You're able to stop these companies and the FCC from getting what they want. And then suppose you then, well, let's say we go further. Suppose you achieve some antitrust provisions where you're actually able to break up these media monopolies. And so then you basically have this pattern about these supposedly diverse markets that then consolidate into where there had been like 50 different major players in around 1983 or so, only to about 5, or maybe by about now 7. It's actually deconcentrated a little bit. But he made the point, though, that even if you go into the most extreme position you could, that of an antitrust provision to break up these media monopolies, what have you done? You basically created all these smaller companies that at some point in the future might have then just re-merge. And so then you're basically in this oscillation back and forth about having this supposedly diverse market consolidate into a small number of players and then broken up again. And so you're basically stuck in this back and forth cycle. What's the point, he actually raised to me. What, is there some other better answer that you could offer to this? And I had to admit at the time I didn't have an answer for that. But that at least got me thinking, you know what, he's right. I should probably look into questions about how an economy might be done that would be beyond this kind of back and forth of concentration and deconcentration that is symptomatic of a market economy. And so I got interested in theoretical economics. I found out about participatory economics. I even helped to found a group called CAPES, the Chicago Area Participatory Economic Society. And here I am in front of all of you, bleeding my heart out. there's going to be a lot here. If people have clarifying questions, and I'm going to go through a lot in admittedly sketch detail, please keep the questions to the end, but please ask. I'll be more than happy to expound on them, and if folks have particular concerns about the model or on details about the model, including on practical applications, this is not just theory in books, this has actually been enacted in practice in a small handful of instances. I'll be happy to talk about them. But on to the model. Part one, what are the values? What's our scorecard? Participatory economics basically outlines 5. And you can actually use them just to list them very briefly. Solidarity, efficiency, equity, diversity, and self-management. You can remember this by the mnemonic that the first letter in each of those words spell out the word seeds. Solidarity, efficiency, equity, diversity, and self-management. Just to go through each of those very briefly. Solidarity basically means a unity of purpose or goals. The idea that we have a shared outcome in what different folks would try to achieve. The fact that you might win doesn't necessarily mean that I would lose. If you gain, we would both gain. We would all gain. Solidarity. Efficiency. Now, this is a kind of loaded word, especially within left political circles. The idea being there that you're not wasting anything what you deem valuable. And I think it's that what you deem valuable that's the controversy here. In that you'll hear, like, I don't know, car manufacturers claiming that they're efficient. Maybe they are, or less efficient. But there, the idea is that some corporation may be doing something they term efficient in terms of not wasting what they deem valuable, most notably money or profit equity or whatever it is. In the case of political activists, you may be something like labor rights or the environment. That would be something where you want to not have waste and to be efficient. So efficiency is one value. Equity, which is basically a synonym for fairness. You want to be sure that you're fair in the course of economic whatever it is, payment usually. So that's one value, equity. Diversity, which basically is a synonym for the greatest possible varieties in path to fulfillment. The fact that you may be able to achieve fulfillment in some way that's different from me, but that's fine. As long as we can each get what we deem valuable and not necessarily be overly restricted on that count. Diversity is the sense. And self-management, which is basically a synonym for you having a say in decisions that affect you. Now, that can vary as far as how much of a say that you might have, especially where there may be overlap on decisions that affect me might be affecting someone else differently. And there's got to be some reasonable way to try to resolve such differences that may inevitably arise. But at least that's the idea. So those are your values. That's our scorecard here, our compass. Solidarity, efficiency, equity, diversity, and self-management. So if we set this up as our gauge of success, how might we try to set up institutions that try to try to achieve these goals, in addition to the usual production, consumption, and allocation that's inevitable in any economy? Well, participatory economics outlines basically four main institutions to achieve this. And I'll just list them off very briefly right now and then explain them in more depth with this brief description and why they're there. One is balanced job complexes. The other is remuneration for effort and sacrifice. Another is self-managed worker and consumer councils. And fourth is participatory planning, par econ's allocation system. So let's describe each of those in some detail. Balanced job complexes. The idea behind that is that jobs are balanced across the economy for desirability and empowerment. Unlike in the case of, say, some modern-day corporation or another various economic systems that have existed throughout history, you may find examples of where you would have a roughly small number of people who have very empowering, very desirable jobs where they would have a lot of say over a lot. And then you would have a greater, larger group of people who have far less say, far less empowering jobs, very onerous many times, that are quite frankly not all that desirable or empowering. The idea behind this institution of balanced job complexes is that jobs are balanced across the economy for desirability and empowerment. I should clarify, though, that does not mean that everyone has to do everything. There will inevitably be specialization, of course. Not everyone will necessarily be skilled to do something like brain surgery. Of course, there's going to be specialization. But that doesn't mean that you can't have a relative balance of desirability and empowerment across those jobs. And not only within, let's say, a single workplace, but also across workplaces. So that, for example, you compare, let's say, a place where you would publish a magazine, like in these times, relatively desirable place, as compared with, say, a coal mine, far less desirable. The idea being of balanced job complexes is that you would not only balance within a workplace, but across workplaces, so that you have this roughly even setup of desirability and empowerment. And the reason this is done, I think, is to prevent the systematic emergence of classes, as I described at the outset, where you would ultimately prevent a small group of people from more or less monopolizing the say of power and desirable work circumstances in a far larger, or maybe even gradations of classes of people who are involved in various economic circumstances that are far less desirable or empowering. That's one institution, balanced job complexes. The second one is remuneration for effort and sacrifice. It's basically the way in a par econ that you get compensated. You get compensated solely by the means of the effort and sacrifice that you enact in the course of your job, in socially valued labor. So that doesn't necessarily mean if I go to my backyard and I dig a hole and then I take the dirt I dug out and then bury it back in, I wouldn't get compensated for that because that isn't necessarily socially valuable. You'd want to do work that would be socially valuable, and it's the effort and sacrifice that you enact in the course of that where you basically get compensated. And that would be gauged as far as practical real-life applications in terms of what's referred to as an effort rating that's the gauged as a result of your most immediate workmates who then basically help to judge that as a result. And that effort quota is capped as a result in order to prevent what's been termed effort rating inflation. But basically the idea is that you get compensated as a result of the sweat equity, effort and sacrifice that you enact. And the reason this is done is because we find it's the most fair way to get paid, basically. And it's because it's the best way that you can actually control things. It's the one thing that's in your most control. In the case of other ways of payment, like, for example, property or talent or luck or other ways, you will find that there's a great deal of luck that has very little to do with whether or not a degree of fairness is involved. At least with regards to remuneration for effort and sacrifice, we feel that's the most fair. So that's the second of the four institutions, payment for remuneration for effort and sacrifice. The third is self-managed worker and consumer councils. This is basically the main decision-making body within participatory economics. You have councils, decision-making body, in both producing things and in consuming things. One person, one vote. You would have them at various different levels because there will be different levels of production and consumption. You would have something that you would consume on an individual level, like, say, a toothbrush. You have something that may be on a family level, like, say, a house, or at a neighborhood level, like a swimming pool, or maybe something at the level of a city the size of Chicago, like, say, a mass transit system. There will be these various levels of consumption needs that will be filled. And so you will have councils that will basically help to provide for those different levels of consumption as needed. You would also have workplace industries and federations in order to basically achieve try to produce the stuff that people are ultimately going to consume. All of these various councils at both worker and consumer ends would abide by what's termed the self-management principle. It's the idea that you have a say in decisions to the proportion that you're affected by the outcome of those decisions. The classic example that's sometimes mentioned. Like, for example, I'm in an office and I want to post a photo of my mother. I love my mother. I want to have a photo of her in my office. I should have a dictatorial say in that because I would be the only one who would be affected. I would see that in the realm of my own office, no one else would. So that's one thing that I would, that's one decision I could make without having to consult with anyone. But suppose in this office I wanted to turn on some really loud music and five other people nearby may be able to hear this. So then who has a say in that? Well, obviously those who are impacted by it. All of us, myself, and everyone else who may be able to hear me, who would hear this and as a result be affected by this decision. So all of us would have to come to some way of arriving at a decision to handle it. That's the idea behind a self-management principle. And that's the way that these councils would basically operate, where decisions would basically be impacted. You would have a greater say on that, and less so if you're less impacted or not at all. And the reason we're doing it as such is because it provides this kind of level of consumption at all levels and promotes the self-management. And the final institution is basically the allocation system for participatory economics, which is very different from the kind of central planning model or market model that we've seen in, or currently see, in economic circumstances in the course of the 20th century. And this is very different. This requires a little bit of explanation in order to get into some detail. And it's also not something you can readily, easily draw with a metaphor. So I'm going to have to describe this in some detail. The basic idea behind it is that you're trying to arrive at a society-wide allocation plan. And there are various tools that you use to try to achieve this. For example, well, we've outlined the fact that there are various councils at varying levels and at both worker and production ends. You've got what are termed indicative prices. Now, this is very different from the kind of price that you might see if you go to a store and you want to buy something. There, that's a number that's more or less a reflection of the bargaining power that's involved in the production or consumption of a given good. In the case of indicative prices in participatory economics, it would not only be a reflection of the relative supply or demand of a good. Obviously, if more people want some good than there's a supply of, price would go up. Less so, the price would go down. But it would also be a reflection of things like the various labor costs that go into something, so that if there's greater labor costs that go into some production, the indicative price would go up. Less so, the cost would go down, and the various environmental impacts that would be involved. So that if there's some production of some good where there's a greater harm on the environment, the price will go up, and less so, the price will go down. You basically have that encapsulated as a number. You would have these councils. You would also have what's termed IFBs, an iteration facilitation boards, which are basically a possible tool that Parikhan suggests to help to try to streamline the process. And what process am I talking about? Here's basically how it would work. Say it's October 1st, 2005, and you basically want to help to try to arrive at an allocation plan for 2006. Each individual actor is going to basically draw up a consumption plan. It's basically you're writing up more or less the goods that you figure you're going to consume on an individual basis, compared with the indicative prices that are likely going to be at play at the time and in the course of the year. Basically, make a list, basically, of what you figure to consume. Likewise, all other actors, at least in the consumption end, are also going to make similar lists in order to help to try to arrive of such things in order to account for larger trends. Basically, make a list, and you submit it. Production folks, like, I don't know, a shoe factory or someone, people who are going to be making the goods that people are going to consume will do likewise for likely consumption needs that they're going to have. So each of these folks and each actor are going to basically arrive at these plans, aggregated if necessary, and distributed to, well, you're not going to have bosses in the participatory economy, so who has a say? But we do have the self-management principle, so it would basically be going to whoever is impacted by your plan. And likewise, plans that other people make that affect you come to you. And as a result of this aggregate set of information that you would then receive, coupled with qualitative information as well, to help to arrive at the sense about whether or not various goods or circumstances may help to account for why prices are up or down over this course of the year. Basically, would then all this information would be aggregated and sent back to you, as was the information you send to all actors that are impacted by your plan, and basically provide feedback in the form of perhaps, say, an up and down vote or qualifications that may be made. And then we receive all the plans back by all the actors who made them. And if we all agree on the fact that on each of our respective plans, we all deem them good and doable, we're done. Chances are you're probably not going to do that on the first try that you try this. So then you would have what are termed, the technical term is iterations. You basically make adjustments on your plan, just as other folks are going to be making adjustments on their respective plans, as circumstances will dictate, as prices may rise, as qualitative information may arrive as a may also arrive as a result. You basically adjust it as need be on the basis of this new set of information, and then resubmit it back. And you basically repeat the process a number of times, anywhere from 3 to 6 to perhaps more. The goal being that you then arrive at a society-wide allocation plan for the entire economy, for which you have a say on things that are impacting on you, and others have a say on things that are impacting on them at all of these levels. And in the sketch outline nutshell, that's basically participatory planning. It's the allocation system, and we do this in order to avoid at both the command planning models and the market models that were basically submitted, that have been basically been used in the past. So those are your four basic institutions in participatory economics. Balanced job complexes, remuneration per effort and sacrifice, self-managed worker and consumer councils, and participatory planning. And we have the last question I'd like to address here is, does these institutions I've just filled out try to achieve the 5 values I outlined at the beginning of this talk? Solidarity, efficiency, equity, diversity, and self-management. Well, let's go through each of those values in a little bit, in turn. Solidarity. Does PARICON try to achieve some solidarity? Well, you think so, especially since with something like a balanced job complex, everyone has a relatively, or you strive to achieve relatively desirable and empowering work for all actors in the economy. Same thing with participatory planning. You would achieve solidarity because you have a shared goal, that of folks being involved in working toward a society-wide allocation plan. And so we all share that same goal. That's all we're working, that's what we're all working to achieve. Same thing with payment, remuneration for effort and sacrifice. All actors in the economy have, they wanted to get paid more. There's the same way they do that, and remuneration per effort and sacrifice. So we think that these institutions try to achieve or promote the value of solidarity. Now, the value of efficiency, there are different ways you could do this. I'll mention one in particular, and actually is kind of stems from a real-life example. Are folks here familiar with what's called the U7 rate? Maybe not. No. Okay. It's basically a rate that the government sets up which mandates a minimum employment or unemployment rate 4% of all Americans are, by virtue of the U7 rate, by law, unemployed. On top of the usual, if you watch, you know, the business press or something, 6 to 8% or whatever the levels happen to be for unemployment. Now that's set up, at least in terms of our current economy, because that sets up a pool of surplus labor to help to try to keep wages down and to prevent, you know, uppity activists like labor unions from using increasing bargaining power they may try to achieve to try to gain greater rights or greater wage levels. And so that's, but nonetheless, by having this pool of surplus labor, you can, some manager or some, I don't know, head of a corporation or whoever can then say, look, you better do what I say, or there's this pool of 4% minimum labor who'd be happy to do your job, so you better shut up and do what I say. And so that's used as a leveling threat. And the reason I mention this is for an efficiency reason within participatory economics. Par Econ deems work as terms of balanced job complexes, where all actors, where they can work, not only do so, but in terms of trying to achieve a reasonable degree of desirability and empowerment. And so that need for having to set up a pool of surplus labor in order to keep wage prices down is eliminated. And the hope is that that pool of surplus labor, folks who can't work, who could work, but can't in order to try to keep labor prices down, can now be brought into the economy and can try to provide meaningful contributions to the economy where they may not be able to otherwise. And that's wasted labor that we hopefully try to reduce, and one way where we hope participatory economics tries to improve efficiency. And this is one example of that. Equity. Does Par Econ try to achieve equity? Fairness in payment. Well, we think so because that's handled by the Institution of Remuneration for Effort and Sacrifice, as we had mentioned before. It's the most fair way to get paid, of basically what you try to put into it in terms of your effort and your sacrifice. Now, is diversity handled with terms of participatory economics? We like to think so because, and I actually could talk about this in Q&A, but I'll actually say that of the various institutions which have been working in the here and now to try to achieve a participatory Par Econ-ish arrangement, you'll find that they do things in fairly different ways. But that's fine, because they may actually make those adjustments for reasons that are particular to various circumstances, rather than having to be forced into the same cookie-cutter mold that something like a McDonald's or a Walmart may currently have, and as a result. Moreover, there are, in one of the books of here that helps to expound the model, Par Econ, Life After Capitalism by Michael Albert, Michael Albert talks about class homogenization effects, which would hopefully also be eliminated in participatory economics, because the institution of balanced job complexes would over time help to eliminate those separate economic classes that may result. Finally, does the institution of self-management, is self-management achieved or propelled further with participatory economics? Well, we think so for two reasons. One is the councils, which operate on a self-management principle. That is that those who are the various economic actors have a say in decisions that are pertinent to them. That's basically the definition of self-management. So we think that goal is achieved. And then there's self-management in the course of participatory planning. You make your adjustments to your plan on the basis of additional information that you get back. Or other people do likewise. And you also try to achieve that kind of shared economic arrangement of trying to achieve a shared allocation plan. So we think that self-management there is also achieved. And so we think that those five goals of solidarity, efficiency, equity, diversity, and self-management, we think, are achieved by the various institutions of participatory economics, balanced job complexes, remuneration for effort and sacrifice, self-managed worker and consumer councils, and participatory planning. That more or less wraps up the talk I'm going to give. And finishing a little bit early, but that's okay. There are very real institutions, real-life applications of what I've just described. It's not just theory. It's also gone into the practice. But I will stop here, and hopefully we'll be able to talk about in the question and answer to follow. But that's all I have to say. Thank you very much. Do you want to start with?
No. Okay. Because what I'm going to do, you know, my apologies in a sense, is read a paper to make sure that I stay within
sure.
The time frame and so on. So let me begin by saying what Michael Albert, Robin Hanel, Mitchell, and I agree on. Okay, we agree that capitalism is a deeply flawed economic system that needs to be replaced by a more humane social order. We agree that capitalism leads to obscene inequalities, it is environmentally destructive, and it's not democratic. Secondly, we agree that the Soviet model of central planning is not the answer. Even democratizing the Soviet model won't work. There's something fundamentally structurally flawed in that model, you know, as an economic model. We agree with that. We agree that we need to be able to articulate an alternative model to both capitalism and the Soviet centralized planning. Critique is not enough. I mean, well, maybe once upon a time critique was enough. It isn't anymore. We've got to be able to answer the question, what's your alternative? We're vulnerable to the Churchillian claim, Winston Churchill, you know, capitalism is the worst of all possible systems, except for all the others. We've got to be able to respond to that, okay? And we agree that participatory democracy should be a fundamental value of the new social order. People should have the right to participate in decisions that affect them, in the workplace as well as society at large. Okay. We agree on a lot, and yet we disagree fundamentally on a number of key issues. Albert is deeply critical of all forms of market socialism, so much so that he refuses. I'm talking about Michael Albert, who's the book Paragon is the most recent, fully articulated version of this, and Mitchell's given an accurate synopsis of the book. The name now given to the model he advocates, socialism, he doesn't want to call Paragon socialism at all, because, to quote, you know, too many perfectly reasonable people associate the label socialism with this model, market socialism, and with associated centrally planned models. For my part, I've long been critical of the Albert Hanel model, recently calling it nonsense on stilts in a web review that Michael Albert, to his credit, published, you know, on ZNet, and he published a long rebuttal to that. He published, you know, my rebuttal to his rebuttal, and then his rebuttal to my rebuttal to his rebuttal. So that's all out there. It's still there on ZNet if you want to check out the details. It's also on the Solidarity Economy website. Okay. So we have many other areas of disagreement, but the most fundamental is our assessment of the market mechanism for allocating resources and distributing goods and services. I argue that the market should not be seen as a unitary phenomenon. I argue that you should think of the market as at least three different kinds of markets. There is a market for goods and services. There's a labor market under capitalism. There's a capital market under capitalism. And I argue that the fundamental problems with capitalism are not due to the market for goods and services, but to that labor market and to that capital market. Those are the ones that need to be radically restructured and, in some sense, abolished and replaced by something else. Now, I admit that the market for goods and services is not wholly benign, but I think when you compare the problems with that market with the problems associated with alternative allocative mechanisms, be they centrally planned socialism or this participatory, decentralized planning, I think the market comes out ahead on that. Okay, so I'm going to support, you know, a certain form of market socialism. Whereas for Albert, and I'll quote, markets aren't a little bad or even just very bad in some contexts. Instead, in all contexts, markets instill antisocial motivations in buyers and sellers, misprice items that are exchanged, misdirect aims regarding as to what to produce and what quantities and by what means, misremunerate the producers, introduce class divisions and class rule, and embody an imperial logic that spreads itself throughout economic life. Albert, you know, and the Paragon people are market abolitionists. Okay. Now, before tackling this issue directly, let me set out the basic institutional structures of a different alternative to capitalism from the Paragon model. It's what I call economic democracy. Now, economic democracy has basically, the simplified model has three fundamental institutions. The first is workplace democracy. Enterprises should be run democratically, governed by their workers. Ultimate authority rests with the workforce, one person, one vote. This is what replaces the labor market under capitalism. No longer is your labor power a commodity to be sold, but when you join an enterprise, you become a member of that enterprise with full voting rights. Okay. Enterprises, second institution, enterprises compete for customers in a relatively free market. So the market is brought over, you know, from capitalism, second institution. Third institution is what I call social control of investment. This is the replacement for the capital markets, okay? Most funds for investment in economic democracy are generated from a capital assets tax, a flat rate tax placed on all enterprises, not from the private savings of wealthy individuals. Okay, these funds are allocated then to various regions of the country and to communities within regions on a per capita basis. They go to public banks that then allocate them to a number of places. They allocate these funds to public capital projects decided on democratically by the community. They allocate them to existing enterprises that want to upgrade their technologies or move into a new line of production or something like that, and to individuals wanting to set up, you know, their own enterprises. That's the basic model. Now, in the more elaborate model that I work out, you know, in my various books, I argue there's at least three other institutions. One, I do have the government acting as employer of last resort. You know, I do think that full employment has long been, you know, a socialist vision, an important part of the socialist tradition. You know, I think this needs to be, you know, advocated. This needs to be institutionalized legally by having the employer guarantee a job to anyone that wants a job and cannot find it, you know, in the market sector of the economy or in the public sector or otherwise. Okay. Secondly, I think in economic democracy, there's actually room for a small capitalist sector. Small businesses in particular, I think, do not necessarily have to be, you know, fully democratic. We might even want to allow for certain entrepreneurial capitalist firms. I think it's a mistake to think that if you have a little bit of capitalism, inevitably it's going to take over, you know, and ruin the society. I don't think that's true. And in any event, you know, I think, you know, we can allow for that. Okay, if it's suitably regulated and so on. And finally, I argue that we need a policy of what I call socialist protectionism. I argue that our society ought to be protectionist in the sense of imposing a tariff on goods coming from low-wage countries because we do not want workers competing against workers to see who will work for the lowest amount, okay? So we're protectionist that way. We don't agree on all forms of competition are valuable. You know, this wage competition is not a good form of competition. However, we want to take the proceeds from these tariffs and rebate them back to the poor countries. So we want to protect our workers, but we also want to do something, you know, for the poorer countries. I won't talk about those institutions here because they're not directly relevant to the disagreements about Paracon, but, you know, if we want to talk about them more in the question and answer period, you know, I'd be happy to. Okay. I've argued at length in various books and articles that such an economic structure would be at least as efficient as capitalism, it would be more rational in its growth, it would be vastly more egalitarian, it would be vastly more democratic, you know, and it would be capable of dealing with, you know, the environmental problems, you know, that are upon us, you know, right now. Just to note a little bit, I won't go into the details, but workplace democracy responds to the Marxian concern about alienated labor. And it's the natural extension of the democratic impulse that has been animating political struggles for the last couple of centuries. Competition among firms ensures that they will be concerned to produce what people want, employ their resources effectively, and be on the lookout for productive innovations. Finally, by controlling the disposition of the social surplus, this social control of investment, society is no longer at the mercy of what Marx calls anarchy of production. People gain conscious control over society's economic development. Okay, now, to proceed to Paracon. This model, as Mitchell's pointed out, can also be characterized by three basic institutions. Balanced job complexes, all jobs are to be equally empowering, both within enterprises and across the economy as a whole. Secondly, remuneration is supposed to be based on effort only and not on one's contribution to society, for the latter includes such morally irrelevant factors as talent, training, job assignment, tools, luck, etc. You know, effort and sacrifice should be the only morally relevant, should be the only determinants of how much remuneration you get for your work. And finally, all elements of production and consumption, labor, resources, consumer goods, are to be allocated by participatory planning, not by the market. Critique. Although I have serious reservations about the mechanism suggested by Albert to accomplish A and B, the balanced job complex and the remuneration only according to effort and sacrifice, I'll pass over them for now, apart from noting that much of what Perricone aspires to in this regard could be accomplished under economic democracy if workers find these reforms desirable. In a democratic workplace, for example, workers have the power to redesign jobs to make them more satisfying. If there's a Perriconista contingent among the workers, they might even persuade their fellow workers to try for equality here. All jobs redesigned to make them equally empowering, whatever that means exactly. Of course, they would not be able to affect equality across enterprises, as is supposed to be the case with Perricone, as Mitchell pointed out. Enterprises that have fewer empowering jobs than average, as determined by some metric suitably devised by someone, they cannot compel workers at the more fortunate enterprises to share their good fortune by letting some of their workers work in the better firms part-time while some of the better firms send their workers to your firm. You can't do that under economic democracy. But within economic democracy, workers are certainly free to redesign, you know, their own enterprise, you know, however a work complex is there, however they see fit. In fact, I would expect, they may not go as far as Perricone says, but I would expect in a democratic workplace that there would be a significant amount of job redesign in order to enhance the, you know, the meaningfulness of the work in all of these places. This is one of the virtues of economic democracy. You've got the ability to do that. Okay. Secondly, a Perriconista contingent within a democratic firm might be able to persuade their fellow workers to have their incomes based solely on effort. Of course, they would have to come up with some way of measuring effort and figure out who's to do the monitoring and measuring. They would also have to persuade their peers that this would not lead to an overall loss of efficiency and hence loss of income, or that if it did reduce overall income, that the moral satisfaction of working in an effort-egalitarian enterprise is worth the income loss. Frankly, I doubt they could persuade their comrades to make such changes, but there's nothing in the structure of economic democracy that would inhibit such an attempt. Indeed, some firms might go for this. And if the restructuring proves successful, the example may catch on, it may spread. Okay. My fundamental objection to Perricone is to the allocation of this, the set of procedures and institutions that are supposed to replace the market. In Perricone, enterprises do not compete for customers. Decentralized participatory planning is supposed to replace the market competition in determining what gets produced in society. Now, critics of central planning have long pointed out that there are two fundamental problems with trying to centrally plan an economy. There are information problems and there are incentive problems. Okay, now, first the information problem. How are producers to know what to produce? One solution is for a central authority to play father knows best and tell people, you know, what they're going to get. If this solution is deemed acceptable, as it is to is unacceptable, as it is deemed so to almost everyone, including, you know, the Perricone people and myself, then producers...
The bucket.
Okay. Then the producers need to have some input from consumers themselves in order to know in detail what items people want and in what quantities. The market solves this problem by letting consumers freely choose to buy from among the goods competing producers offer. Producers must respond to consumer demand, producing more of what people want the most, judged by their willingness to pay, cutting back on the things that are less in demand. This adjustment of supply and demand takes place automatically without any central authority deciding the quantity and quality of what is being produced, without individuals having to specify in advance what they want, without any consumer councils weighing alternative possibilities, without voters having to vote on aggregated production plans. People shop. Producers see what people are buying, they respond. Now, of course, producers also go to great lengths to persuade people to buy their products, an effort that's reached gigantic, almost laughable proportions in contemporary capitalism. This must be taken into account when assessing alternatives, and the alternatives to whether the sales effort can be regulated so as to mitigate the worst abuses, or whether the market has to be scrapped altogether. Let's see what the alternative might be. But then, before the information, in addition to the information problem, there's the incentive problem. Suppose you do know what people want. Okay, there's a list of incentives that you got to deal with here. First of all, how do you motivate producers to care about what people want? How do we motivate them to produce more of the items in demand and cut back on those that aren't in demand? Secondly, how do we motivate enterprises to upgrade their products, you know, to refine them, to make them more functional, you know, more attractive? Three, how do we motivate them to produce efficiently, to use their resources at their disposal in an effective manner and not squander them? Four, how do we motivate workers themselves to work conscientiously? And finally, how do we motivate enterprises to innovate, to introduce new products or new technologies? In a market economy, all of these questions are answered with one word, competition. Those enterprises that are concerned to find out what their customers want, to marshal their labor and non-labor resources efficiently, and to innovate, make more money than those that don't. If we give up the market competition, what is to replace this crude but effective motivator? Okay, Albert and Hanel, fully aware of this problem. How does Perricon address them? Well, in my 1993 book called Against Capitalism, I offered a criticism of their handling of the information problem. My critique was utterly ineffectual. The 2003 model, Perricon, is no different from the model I criticized, you know, back in 1993. So let me just sort of repeat what I wrote then, you know, basically. Suppose we agree that central planning is inherently authoritarian and the market is inherently alienated. We will accept planning, but not centralized planning. We don't want the market at all. What we want is an economy coordinated by decentralized, non-authoritarian, democratic planning. Democratic socialists have long dreamed this dream, but its feasibility has been repeatedly called into question, sometimes quite bluntly. Alek Nova, for example, an economist who spent a long time studying the Soviet Union and became an early advocate of market socialism, admits to feeling increasingly ill-disposed toward those who, quote, substitute for hard thinking the image of a post-revolutionary world in which there would be no economic problems at all, or where any problems that might arise would be handled smoothly by the associated producers of a world commonwealth. However, in a complex industrial economy, he says, the interrelation between its parts can be based in principle either on freely chosen negotiated contracts, which means autonomy and a species of commodity production, or on a system of binding instructions from planning offices. There is no third way. Now, Michael Albert, co-editor and co-founder of Z Magazine, and Robin Hanel, professor of economics at American University, refused to concede. In their 1978 book, and their model actually is antedates, you know, the 1993 version, their 1978 book called Unorthodox Marxism put forth a proposal for exactly what that, a third way involving neither central planning nor the market. But it was widely criticized for its lack of feasibility. Recently, this is writing back in 93, this was the 1991 version, they've tried again, this time to incorporate computers into their model in a big way. Now, to be fair, they deserve credit for thinking through in considerable detail the model for an egalitarian, participatory, non-market economy. But I have to say, the proposal still seems to me quite mad. Perhaps I'm being too harsh. You be the judge. The basic idea is simple enough. Start with Robinson Crusoe on an island. He must choose a job complex, that is a pattern of work involving activities of various degrees of pleasure and discomfort, a consumption proposal, i.e., what does he want to consume, and a production proposal, how much is he willing to work. Okay. From among the infinite number of possible combinations of these three choices, he must settle on a set that's consistent. That is to say, he must choose to put in a sufficient amount of time at an appropriate set of tasks to satisfy his desires. Okay. Suppose Friday appears, and he and Robinson are committed to participatory democracy and equality. They can doubtlessly benefit from cooperating, have some division of labor here, but the cooperation must be fair. Each says what he would like to consume and how long he's willing to work. The two negotiate the matter, subject to the proviso that their job complexes, although not necessarily identical, are balanced, i.e. each involves roughly the same amount of empowerment. Robinson may want to consume a bit more than Friday, but he'll work longer. They discuss these matters, talk about the good and bad effects of various forms of consumption, point out exactly what's involved in doing various kinds of work. In the end, they agree on a plan. Notice, neither market nor central authority. Okay, now, extend this model from two people to, say, 200 million. Okay, and you have the Albert Hanel model for a participatory economy for the United States, now called Paracon. To be sure, things are getting a bit more complicated, but there are computers now and various facilitation boards to make things easier. How does it work? Okay, well, Mitchell's giving you a version. Let me give you my take on this, and I think it's the same. At the beginning of the new year, or at some other agreed-upon date, you simply type into your computer what you would like to consume for the year. Let me repeat. You are to list everything you would like to consume during the year. Food, clothing, shelter, entertainment, and so on. Okay. And you're going to have to do this in fairly specific detail. You can't just say meat. The producer's got to know what kind of meat. You know, you can't say a ton of meat. You got to break it down and, you know, and so on and so forth. You got to list it. Okay. This isn't all that complicated, you know, we're told, since you have your own file, your list from last year. Okay. Most likely you'll only need to tweak it a bit. You'll also be given a list of prices, most likely not too different from last year's. You must stay within your expected income for the coming year, which is determined primarily by the number of hours you're willing to work. Everyone in the country does this, in all 150 million or so households. Okay. All the data is collected. If supply and demand don't match, prices are adjusted. Prices are raised for those for which there's an excess demand, lowered for those for which there's excess supply. Your initial list is returned to you, okay? And you have to recalculate it, okay, and readjust it. That is to say, if you're now over budget due to certain price increases, you got to decide whether you're willing to work longer or consume less. If latter, you got to decide what to cut out. If you're under budget, you decide to work less, consume more. You got to say what you'd like to add, okay? Here's how Albert describes it, quote, using last year's final prices as starting indicators of social costs and benefits, each person develops a proposal for the coming year, not only enumerating what she wants to consume or produce, but also providing qualitative information about her reasons. This proposal enters the mix with all others. Feedback arrives, revisions are made round by round until a final decision is reached. Now, I quote Albert here because I don't want you to think I'm exaggerating. He insists that compiling and revising your consumption request for the year shouldn't be all that difficult, taking up no more time than it takes to fill out your income tax forms, you know, today. Actually, I'm simplifying the process a bit. After compiling your original list, you actually have to take it to your neighborhood council, which, quote, either approves or disapproves all requests and organizes them into a grand council request. These requests are forwarded to ward councils, which look them over, approve or disapprove, collate them, send them up to city consumption councils, and so on. I left out something else. In deciding whether to approve your proposal or not, there's a discussion of the possible harmful effects of certain kinds of consumption your neighbors and you have selected. Now, this is done anonymously, names are deleted, and so on. When the neighborhood council agrees on everything, it takes these collated totals to the ward council, representing various neighborhoods in the ward, the members of which must also reach an agreement. You may be asked to reconsider some of your choices if such an agreement, you know, hits a snag. From there, the collated totals go to the City Federation of Consumption Councils, from there to the State Federation, from there to the Regional Federation, from there to the National Federation. At each stage, there's debate, negotiation, reconsideration, but eventually, hopefully, there's acceptance. Computers facilitate matters. keeping all participants informed at each stage as to what the averages are so that everyone knows whether or not his ward or city or region or state is out of line. A similar procedure suitably arranges all job complexes to be equally balanced and for individuals in neighborhoods and cities and states and regions to propose how much work they're willing to do in relation to desired consumption. Again, computers facilitate. Of course, in the end, supply and demand should match. The final match comes about as follows. After five or so iterations of this procedure, the Iteration Facilitation Board surveys all the accumulated data, then proposes five feasible plans, i.e. those in which the amount of work offered suffices to produce the goods requested. These are plans for the entire national economy. Let me quote Albert again. What would distinguish the five plans is that each would entail slightly different total product, work expended, average consumption, and average investment. Everyone would then vote in units for one of the five feasible plans. Once one of these plans was chosen as the base operating plan, units could adjust their request in subsequent iterations in conformity with the base plan until the individual agreements were also reached. Now, I've already indicated my summary judgment on all this. It strikes me as quite mad. I summarized how Perricon deals with the information problem, how to get the information about what people want to the producers. I haven't touched yet on what most critics find the more difficult problem, namely the incentive problem. You know, once you've got the information, how do you motivate producers to respond effectively to this information? I'll be brief because Albert is less systematic in dealing with these. The key question is this. What determines the amount of money an enterprise has to distribute among its workforce? Perricon is rather vague about this. We can't have enterprises selling their output to consumers and dividing up the proceeds. That would be the market solution. But if an enterprise is simply reimbursed according to hours worked, there's no incentive to work hard or use resources efficiently. Hence, external monitoring will be necessary, and Albert agrees with this, to ensure that workers are working at least average intensity and using their resources in a reasonably efficient manner. Albert says that everyone will benefit from working harder since overall productivity will rise, which is true, but there's a huge free rider problem here. My extra effort will benefit, you know, national productivity by an infinitesimal amount, but slacking, you know, yields quite palpable dividends, you know, to me. Immediate tangible benefits, and this is true for everyone. So unless the external monitoring is pervasive, honest, and effective, enterprises have little reason to encourage hard work or efficient utilization of resources or to pay attention to the quality of their output. Clearly, if we want to encourage efficient production without recourse to markets, we'll have to introduce differential rewards, which means there must be a monitoring agency empowered to make quantitative assessments as to how much above or below average each enterprise is performing and how much should be rewarded or docked for their comparative performances. Needless to say, this agency, which must monitor all productive enterprises of the nation, must be above reproach with regard to both competence and integrity. And also, we don't want a controlling class to develop, so the people on these monitoring boards have to be rotated, you know, rather, you know, frequently. So that lots of people get a chance. As for the incentive to innovate, Albert hopes that social recognition will suffice. But if not, to quote, extra consumption allowances could be granted to innovators for a limited amount of time. Of course, social recognition also motivates under capitalism and under economic democracy, so Perricon doesn't add anything on that score. But if we introduce his economic incentives, we must set up another agency, one that will determine who is worthy of the extra reward and how much. This agency, too, must be staffed by competent employees of impeccable integrity. A tall order. I think I've said enough. I find economic democracy to be quite feasible alternative to capitalism that would be vastly preferable to the insane economic order that now dominates the globe. I don't find Perricon to be even remotely feasible as a real-world alternative to capitalism, nor do I find it, leaving feasibility considerations aside, to be an attractive ideal. Perhaps I'm missing something, but I cannot for the life of me understand why anyone would want to live in such a society. Thank you. So I guess what?
Yeah, now it's
anyone that
your turn.
To comment or to say anything to either one of us.
Yeah, I've got lots of thoughts about what you had said, but I don't. Let's let other folks talk. Sir, you have your hand up. Talk loud, please.
What's that?
Talk loud.
Loud. All right. It seems that you're both looking for an alternative model to capitalism. Karl Marx looked for an alternative model years ago. He thought that capitalism would destroy everything within it. And so he came up with the other extreme. We tried to prove he was wrong. We regulated capitalism so it wouldn't happen. Well, now we've deregulated and we have the free enterprise of firms. So I think that the answer really is regulated capitalism. Maybe there's no truism. There's only degrees of ism. So we need. You have to have checks and balances in both the political system and the economic system. Politically, we can't be said to be balanced. We have constitutional representative government to avoid the extremes of dictatorship or anarchy. Well, economically, the same rules apply. We have a total free enterprise system, no breaks, no chains, no regulation. Let it rip. Unregulated competition evolves into combination, forms of monopoly, economic dictatorship. You end up with a handful of corporations controlling everything, including the government. Some people call that fascism. That's the direction we've been moving in. The opposite extreme would be said to be raw socialism, and nothing works. There's no incentive to get anything done. So the only way I know how to balance an economy is in labor laws and regulation. The purpose of regulation, contrary to popular belief, was never to put the government on the backs of people, but to harness the forces of profit and greed and make it work for society instead of against it. So the making of money, providing a service, running trains, all the rest, go hand in hand, vis-a-vis carving up your neighbor, going out of business, disagreeing on the horizon with your pile of money, looking for greener pastures to exploit, leaving trails of carnage and broken bodies behind you. But anyway, I think that's where you need to go.
You want to respond?
Okay. Well, there's a lot to say there. I'll start with my personal experience on this. I would do a lot of work on media-related issues and political activism on media stuff with Chicago Media Action. And what you described is what I'm doing now. I'm working to try to regulate these gigantic, massive corporations that have run roughshod over the world under the rubric of what's termed neoliberalism. Markets are great, and therefore, since they're great, and in fact, it's actually the big critique I have about markets is that I think that if you wanted to strike the heart of a lot of the major corporations that are working pretty seriously at ruining the world in lots of different ways, I think the simple way there is to get rid of markets. Well, then two questions there result. One, what do you put in its place? And two, how do you do that, even if you can? On the case of the one, what do you put in its place? Well, I gave a half hour talk about that model. Two, how do you get there? Much harder problem. One suggestion that's been suggested by Robin Hanel and by Derek Wall in an excellent book he published called Babylon and Beyond, they basically take the approach of activists being amphibious. The idea that, A, you should also be involved in political activism in the here and now to try to, you know, improve things in the here and now, but also have an eye toward something else or something better so that we don't have to basically, as I described at the very beginning of my talk, that we're basically, I mean, I'll mention one example of especially the corporation I'm probably going to spend the next 4 months fighting, AT&T. In 1984, AT&T was this gigantic monopoly that as a result of an eight-year-long antitrust provision was finally broken up into 22 smaller regional companies and 8 larger Bell operating companies. And over the course of the last 20 years, that's more or less been remerged, mainly through the market context that's been revived at. I mean, of course, there are, you know, particular details about how that would happen, and I can describe rhythm and verse regarding what happened at the FCC just this past year. But the point being is that context relies crucially on markets. And then so then, yeah, you're spending all this time to try to abolish something, it basically reconstitutes. Stephen Colbert, the Colbert Report, described it as AT&T being the T-1000 of corporations. Have you ever seen the movie Terminator 2, Judgment Day? You get the idea there. But the idea being that, yeah, you've got Frankenstein to basically stitch itself right back up. But it does so in that context, the competitive context of a market, where I gain and you lose as a result of me, you know, if I win, you lose. If you win, I lose. And as a result, the advantage in that context is to basically assemble a monster. And that's, if you've ever seen the movie or read the book by Joel Bakan, The Corporation, that's what a corporation is. And so that's where I think the advantage there lies, mainly because of that market context. So there the solution would be get rid of markets, but okay, I'll let you talk.
Let me just, let me say something also, because I mean, I agree, I think that you've got to re-regulate capitalism, but I don't think that will do it. You've got to ask the question, what happened to the regulation? Why did the regulated capitalism that developed after the Second World War, that was sort of the golden age, what happened? And I think there's a fundamental structural problem at the heart of capitalism. Capitalism means you've got one group of people that basically own the means of production and another group of people that work there. You know, you've got to have a way of disciplining the workforce. Okay? Can't whip them anymore. You know, they're not slaves. They're free. Okay? You've got to be able to fire them. And that's why unemployment is a crucial fundamental structural feature of capitalism. And unemployment's not only has to be there and it's significant, but it's got to be pretty miserable when you're there, or else it doesn't serve that function. So that any time the kind of Keynesian regulation tries to reduce unemployment too low, workers start getting uppity because they're not as afraid anymore of losing their job. They start asking for better conditions. They start asking for more money. Corporations or companies turn around, raise prices, and you've got what was the scourge of the late 70s? Stagflation. You get a stagnating economy, still got unemployment. You know, the regulations don't work, finally. I mean, they're better, you know, than unregulated capitalism, for sure, and you know, we got to move in that direction, you know, to get beyond that. But I think I realize you can't just regulate capitalism and expect it to function properly. Yeah. Let's see. Carl, you had your hand up, and then you want to respond.
Yeah, please. Excuse me. What? We're responding. Please make it brief.
All right. The regulated. I'm losing it now. Took me off my train of thought.
Okay.
Carl. I thought long and hard about this. First, I'm going to be very orthodox. Marxism. The market is an achievement of human civilization. Consider what was before. Plunder, pillage, and theft. That's what the market replaces.
Riches.
We've got some of that going on. But fortunately, not among
we're the problem.
Second, I think fair on information theory. Decisions can be made in a series or in parallel. Series decisions are where decisions are made one after the other. Parallel decisions all go forward at once. The series decisions of a planned economy take an enormous amount of time because one decision has to be made after the previous decision. The market, especially in consumer goods, you go and buy and sell, you go to the store, they scan your product as you want. A billion decisions get made at the same time. That's what gives it its advantage. Parallel decision making as opposed to serial decision making. And that's why Paracon collapses into endless meetings. To be, finally, examples. There is an example of Paracon in the world. Two of them that I know of. One is Z Magazine and South Enterprise. The other era, the Amish. Amish people practice a form of participatory economics. market a little bit, but basically they join together to move their barns. It works on that scale. On the other hand, what David's talking about existed on a large scale. It's probably not all over the place. It's existed for quite a number of years in one province in Spain. It's happening now in Venezuela and Argentina. And all over the place, people are picking up on this model and implementing it successfully. Their hunt isn't, besides what the Amish do, is not being implemented successfully in advanced industrial or post-industrial society. Unless somebody can jump in quicker, I don't see how you can get there. The main question is, how do we get here to there? And the problem is the market will exist as long as there's scarcity. Markets wither away when there's abundance. As long as there's scarcity, I don't care what system it is. Even if you have a camp command economy like Stalin or Pol Pot and abolish money in the market is still there. It's called the black market because scarcity still exists. And until you abolish scarcity, the market will persist. So the question is, how best to use it for your advantage and regulate it?
And do you want to respond? Or?
No.
No? Okay. I can just respond briefly to some of Carl's points, just pretty briefly. There's nothing I've said or that is in the model that says that parallel decision-making can't happen with serial decision-making, where, and in fact, as I described in the description of it, you will find these various councils at all different levels making their own plans at the same time. That's decision-making in parallel. And then, of course, there will be, you know, sequential decisions that will be made as a result. That's the whole point of the iterations. As the issue regarding meetings, the whole point of the participatory planning arrangement is that, in fact, it was designed as such that there wouldn't be any meetings. I suppose you could, but the whole point of the arrangement is not so much that, you know, all, whatever, 60 of us in this room here, all together, get together and we have a meeting. No, we all try to arrive at some kind of arrangement, submit a plan, receive that feedback back as a result, and then proceed further and to arrive at what we hope is a sufficient and efficient allocation plan. David, are you going to say?
No, I'll just say.
Okay.
You wanted to do your follow-up and then we'll...
Yeah.
The antitrust laws were the one acts that were made by our Congress to attempt to control the abuse of capitalism years ago. And the Sherman Antitrust Act, Clayton Act, Federal Trade Commission Act, they put them all together and say, what do they mean? Any business combination could be shown to be adverse to the public interest, and to that degree be declared in violation of antitrust. AT&T, your example,
right,
many years ago,
mm-hmm,
was regulated at the cost of capital, which at the time was 6%. They told AT&T, if you make more than 6% profit or pay more than 6% in dividends, we'll force you to cut the phone rates. Otherwise, you have a free hand. So every year AT&T saw they could make more than 6%, which was every year, they'd spend the money. R&D, Bell Labs, new technology, new products, mm-hmm, Western Electric, space program, you name it, they got in it. Instead of making 6% in a small capital base, they made it on a huge capital base. Made thousands of times of profits, it was never usurious, worked everyone's benefit, created all kinds of jobs, steady, stable growth, in a sense, a technological revolution. When they broke up AT&T, it was Judge Green, but actually at that time, if you remember, the treasury bills were selling for 11% due to sustained heavy government deficit spending over a long period of time. Nominal profit margins were about 12% to pay 11% loans. AT&T was paying 6. They went to the government and said, we can't compete with the treasury bill. We're losing our investment base. They said, fine, you can go to 12. They went to 12. The treasury bill went to 16 overnight. Then they said, break them up. Then they called them a monopoly, which they were all along. You were a regulated monopoly. When they broke them up, now we have several smaller unregulated monopolies and they're back together again. That's what happened. You were asking what happened. That was part of it. But the future, what to do? I'll try to be brief. I'll live up to your expectations. And what we need to do is re-regulate. Well, the only place we can re-regulate is where people can understand regulation is needed. I'm for rate of return regulation in those industries that directly affect the public interest. Traditionally, that was communications, transportation, public utilities. We've deregulated all of this. We're suffering the adverse effects of same. People can't identify. There's one area that has never been regulated that shouts for it, is healthcare. The entire healthcare system is robbing us blind in the sense of, you know, we're overpaying for it. It's almost like a cartel. So we need to regulate it down to a reasonable rate of return. We need to, in Congress, we need to force them to put in a health care commission to regulate that area. Perhaps we should regulate the oil companies down to a reasonable rate of return. Other areas. This way we can manage what we're doing. Thank you.
You used a phrase, and I'm not sure exactly what it was, but I took it to mean the market kind of does something, and it does it efficiently, and there was no proof to back that up, and it doesn't allocate, that it makes these allocation decisions just by math. But really, like, there are a lot of departments and corporations that decide what to produce based on what they guess they can set, you know, and there's a lot of work that goes into that. It's not like this magical thing where no work gets put into it. I think that's an kind of an idea in market discussion. Well,
corporations are not pure expressions of the market by any stretch, though.
Sure.
They're distortions.
Well, or maybe not.
But the point would be there's no central authority doing it. I mean, you know, there is a lot of discussion, a lot of guessing, a lot of focus groups and so on to try to decide. But ultimately, you got to put it out there and see if anyone's going to buy it or not. And if they don't, you guessed wrong, you know. But you've got a motivation and an incentive to try to get it right because there's a lot at stake, you know. And I'm arguing under Paragon, you don't have that motivation.
Isn't the motivation that you don't waste all that stuff you would have wasted that you didn't produce? Like, if you produce something and you guess wrong, which, admittedly, in markets, guess wrong is a lot.
Right.
Isn't the motivation there to do it so that you actually have inputs instead of just guessing? I mean, if you want to try
but see, the input
to buy something, mm-hmm. I can trick you into buying stuff.
Right.
Which we go through every day. Okay, so the point is, isn't it better then not to try and trick somebody into buying something that they don't want, and that's all that you offer, or one of the things that you offer, or that you actually try and sell things to people or collaborate with them on the things they do want?
Okay, but my point would be, how do you know what people want? Okay, and apparently you get this report back saying your factors, people want 10,000 pairs of blue jeans or something. Okay, well, that's what they want, you know. Let's work. You know, do we have to worry about what style they want or something? Not particularly. We've been told to produce 10,000 pair of blue, or maybe we've been, you know, broken down. We're supposed to do all. But what motivation? Because your income is not going to be determined by do these things sell or not.
Sure.
No, mm-hmm. No. You just do what you're told, you know, and do it effectively. How do we know that it's being done effectively?
Well,
incentive only if there's a monitor saying if you don't, you're going to suffer. If you don't do it right, we're going to penalize you. So the question is, who's going to do the monitoring? You're going to have to set up some kind of agency that's going to have to look. They're going to have to go in. They're going to say, are you guys working hard enough? Are you wasting your resources over here? You know, are you paying enough attention? Well, we don't think you are, and so we're going to dock your pay. Or we think you're doing great. This is the alternative, some external authority, that then, of course, there's going to be a huge amount of motivation. Well, let's bribe those guys to make sure they get, you know, there's a huge, you know, incentive now to get involved in corrupting this, which is exactly what happened under Soviet central planning.
It's the same thing that happens now too, though. Let's flip the incentive as well, and let's flip it to the other side. Okay, so if you're working off a market mm-hmm. system, like let's take your model. There's a lot of question about incentives, all right? But what's the incentive in your model?
Because if you don't produce what people want, they don't buy it, and you suffer. Because your income comes from what do you sell out there?
Okay, so you can earn more if you sell more.
That's right.
Okay, so then what does that do down the road for creating class division?
I don't see why selling more necessarily creates class division.
If you have guaranteed employment, how do you suffer?
Right, you got guaranteed full employment. Will there be some inequalities? Yes, of course. You know, otherwise there's no monetary incentives. That's also true under Paragon. Don't we notice yet? Some groups that are the monitors saying are doing well, they get more.
But if money is the incentive, then you have the same system that, in a lot of ways, you have here.
No. That's the big mistake. They don't all just because they all use money, just because they all use markets, does not make them the same. They got fundamentally different dynamics.
Well, sure, absolutely. But you have the same issues if money is the incentive.
Somebody else? Call on somebody.
No, there's a lot of hands. Let's go here, sir.
Yeah, I don't know if I can add anything, only that I would like to thank the speakers and the group for bringing up a subject that is the survival that we need to think about. If we don't solve these problems, we will be in hot water pretty soon. The human beings are very complex, and we cannot say that somebody's incentive would be the same for somebody else. But I don't think that the solution is external regulation or designing a different system. I think the solution to all these problems will come from every individual, by education and by confronting with the realities of the world as it's coming to us, whether it is by the effects of global warming or nuclear disasters or even nuclear war, we will have to decide what is survival for each one of us. And this amount of productivity that it makes, pardon the expression, but a plastic shit, we are flooded with plastic shit. It doesn't mean nothing for the happiness, for the survival of the system. This is a run amok just way of consuming. Mm-hmm. We don't put any attention on the disaster that we are creating, but we are consuming. And unless every individual or most of the individuals come to the realization that unless we control our internal desire for all these plastic, whatever you want to call, then we are not going to have a solution, because it will be corruption, it will be very complex systems that will never end up working. So how do we get from here to the point that all of us decide enough is enough?
See, I would say you got two things going on. One, you have to have consciousness changing, but you also need structural changes, because the problem, say, with producing plastic, under capitalism, you say, yeah, we realize we're producing too much. But if you say, ban the production of plastics or cut them back, all of a sudden, lots of people are thrown out of work, so they're not going to support this. You know, the enterprises that are making this, they're not going to support that. You know, they're going to go bankrupt. So you're going to have this countervailing forces there. But if you have an economy that says, look, we control investment, you know, we're not just going to let people be thrown out of work, we've got government as employer of last resort, and we've got control over investment, so we can see that things are reinvested in a different sort of way, we've got a structure there that is compatible with. I mean, you need the change of consciousness, but you also need a set of economic structures that are compatible with that change of consciousness, and I don't think capitalism is compatible with that.
Notice that I didn't ask for banning anything. If it comes from us, from the society itself, there will be a no resistance to stop doing certain things as we are doing. Well, the way we travel here in the United States, go to Europe and see the difference. We are not questioning what we're doing. What for? What are we doing before? What are we looking for? I don't think I don't think a lot of people question this. What for do we want these things? That's my opinion.
Well, remember that in the current, as I try to open this tape up, in the course of the current context, you got it? In the course of the current, a lot of people are consuming stuff that they don't need. But remember, though, that in the current context, a lot of those needs are manufactured. I mean, a lot of people will see, you know, advertisements on TV, media, and we'll know a little something about this. And as a result of especially seeing them upwards of anywhere from 10 to 20,000 times over the course of a year, far more than any kind of societal impact. Unfortunately, it's gotten to that point. So, that's one serious factor into all of this. Remember, though, that context, I mean, at least in the current play, happens as a result of, I would point to two particular things. One, well, obviously the market context. The folks are there going to want to, in order to increase their particular profits in the course of some corporation that thrive in the market, would work to get people to buy their stuff and make all kinds of outlandish promises to that effect, or maybe just declare as the famous remark by in the cartoon Calvin and Hobbes, "Hey Dad, I saw a bunch of products on TV that I didn't know exist, but which I desperately need." So, yeah, those are factors there that are going to play in.
You had to have?
I'm going to say a couple of things. Number one, I've heard like four different meanings for market. Like, for example, you're saying production, consumption. Mm-hmm. We added the part about the products itself. This man, don't know his name, back there, he was talking about the markets, and he had a different meaning to it. And markets are a process. And it's basically selling and buying. And that's been going on forever. It may not have been with money, it might have been the barter system. So we can consider that the markets. But it's not an object, it's a process. I'm in favor of Paragon. I haven't read your book. I've read some of your articles, did some research on you, things like that. And I've lived in a socialist democracy. I lived in Spain for 8 years. So I changed from Franco time into the PSOE of Spain. I didn't find it better than straight capitalism. Still has its flaws. You still have corporations which have tremendous influence over the government and stuff. But what I've seen in Europe, and talking to my friends in Europe, is life's gotten worse. And it's not one. It's all of them. You can talk up with people in Sweden. You can talk to different countries. My research points to one institution that's been doing this, not just here in the United States, but also in Europe, also in Japan, and then I would say in the 90s, began to spread all over the world, which is the Trilateral Commission, which is just an aggregation of the largest corporations from Japan, United States, Europe. It started like that, but now you have them just about all the countries that we trade with, and those are the ones who are making the policies. Even in education, you'll see some new changes in higher education, which they're doing, which is coming from the OECD, which is the Organization for Economics, Cooperative Development. And basically what they're trying to make of, especially in higher education, is standardized testing. Standardized testing, major flaw in it is they'll test you for knowledge, they'll test you for comprehension, they can test you for application, they can't test you for synthesis, they can't test you for evaluation, and can't test you for analysis. So basically they're dumbing down. You as a philosophy teacher, you know critical thinking is very, very important. We're going to get out of the situation we're in. That being said, about motivation, what you call, I forgot the word you called it, I call it social loafing. The term they use in psychology is social loafing. And then the other side of it, the sucker effect. And the sucker effect is basically, if someone who can do, let's say, make 20 widgets an hour, goes into a company, and everyone in that company can only make 10, within a couple of months, the guy who can make 20 will come down to 10, because he'll want to be the same. And the question comes down, how do you change that in any society, in any organization? And it's team, the team concept. It basically, you don't have social law in basketball teams. You don't have them in football teams. Because they feel like a team, and everyone's sharing in that. So if you want an organization that doesn't have the social law problem, you have to go... And you have to place that in there. The complexities of the information problem that man back there was talking about, and I heard him, he said there's only serial, there's only parallel. There's also multiplexing, which also includes the serial, also includes the parallel. But it goes further than that, in that it looks for sources of information within specializations. So for example, they do this a lot in hospital, things like that. You got that patient has multiple needs, and what you do is you call in, let's say the guy's gonna work on his heart, the guy's gonna work on his liver, person's been doing the analysis of blood, they come together, they discuss it, and they find some type of treatment for that person. That's not in serial, that's not in parallel. But it does have those two components plus the other component. Then you have people who are specialized with those types of problems.
Can I respond to a couple of things you said?
Sure.
Okay. Because this issue of markets have always been with us, you know, but there are different forms of market. Let me give you just a very concrete idea. The deregulation that took place, you know, above all was deregulation of capital markets, okay? I mean, and this ability of capital to move anywhere in the world that it wants to move. Now notice, under economic democracy, that wouldn't happen because the capital, the investment funds, are public funds generated by a tax on enterprise profits. They stay in the country by law. Notice also, a big, you say, well, firms, if they're in a market, they're going to behave the same whether they're democratically run or whether they're capitalist firms. No. Here's one thing a democratically run firm will never do. It will never say, well, let's close down our shop and move to Haiti, say, or Mexico, say, or Thailand, say, because it's cheaper there. Nobody's going to do that. So you don't have to worry about runaway shops. You don't have to worry about capital leaving the country. And it's part of the problem with the deregulation of capital markets is that's why governments can't regulate as well anymore, because you start regulating an industry, they say, well, gee, we'll just move it somewhere else, okay? And we're free to do that, you know? So if you realize it's the capital you got to get control over, and you got to democratize that labor, that solves the fundamental problems. The other problems, you know, is there too much advertising? Are people being persuaded to buy things they don't? That's not the same order of magnitude. That can be dealt with, you know, by regulatory means and so on, I think.
You'll notice in the model, just to briefly address some of the point, in the course of the participatory economic model, there wasn't anything I had said regarding a polity, a government-related apparatus. It's all economics. Decisions would be made within the economic sphere. I mean, there'll be some where there may be some involvement of a polity, and it's actually it doesn't necessarily have to mean a state, but whatever. In fact, there actually are models of Steve Shalhoub, most notably, having formed models of a political sphere that would be compatible with the economic sphere suggested by participatory economics, and similar models along this way. In the next year or so, AK Press is going to be publishing a book which is going to be a compilation of these various models of a participatory society in the economic sphere, in the government sphere, in the community sphere, in what's called the kinship sphere, and in other spheres. Chicago Area Participatory Economic Society has been asked to submit a chapter to this book. Hans?
You had your hand over there.
Let's go over here.
I have my hand up because I wanted to ask you a question. How do you think that we can move forward to get a grip on the capital part of the market?
How to move forward? Well, I think there's growing awareness that these capital markets are out of control. And in addition, there's a lot of anxiety about, you know, the possibility of these huge financial meltdown, you know. These markets are unregulated, you know, they're going to have to be re-regulated in some way. So I think, you know, you're going to have to start talking about regulating capital flows, you know. And I think that can be done within the context of capitalism itself, okay. And it used to be, in Italy, for example, you couldn't just invest somewhere else. You had to go through all kind of government approval before you could take money out of the country and invest it somewhere else and so on. Now, that's going to be a struggle, and companies are going to say, we can't do that. But on the other hand, there's a certain sense in a lot of quarters, this deregulation has sort of gotten out of hand. You know, we're going to have to do something about that, okay? And, you know, I think there's, you know, various kinds of political, you know, struggles are going to be, you know, fought over that. Another thing I wanted to mention though quickly in terms of this notion of markets and competition that I think is important. It's not true that all competition is the same, okay? And one of the crucial structural differences between a democratic firm and a capitalist firm, democratic firms don't tend to expand as rapidly. They don't have the same expansionary motivation. And the reason is simply because when you expand, you take on more workers. That means you've got to divide up your profits among more people. Okay? So you don't have nearly the incentive to keep growing, you know, that you do under a capitalist firm. You've got no incentive to drive your competitor out of business. When you drive your competitor out of business, you're going to have to take on twice as many workers to produce what they were producing, you know, and you're going to have to divide it up among twice as many people. So it's a controlled competition. I like to think of it kind of on the model of athletic competition. You know, competition in itself isn't a bad thing, you know, so long as, because, you know, it, it, It puts pressure on you to perform, you know, to bring out the best, to be creative, so long as the losers don't lose too badly, okay? And notice how it works, you know, in athletic competition. You lose the game, but, you know, that's not the end of the world. You know, and you also structure your leagues, you know, professional leagues, so that the people that lose the most get first draft pick and so on, because you want to keep the competition, you know, balanced, okay? That's the kind of competition you get, you know, in a democratic force. It's not the kind of competition you get under capitalism, where there's every incentive to swallow up your competitors, to become monopolies, and so on. That tendency to monopoly does recur under capitalism, but I think it's not there to the same degree under economic democracy.
Yes. I
just wanted to raise a question with David.
Louder, please.
Yeah, I wanted to raise a question with David on this notion of market capitalism. You know, if we look historically, I mean, we have there's a plethora of examples. I'm thinking of Perestroika, the situation in Yugoslavia, Titoism. You know, where there was a, if you want to say, Hungary, reintroduction today, China, reintroduction of capitalist modes that, like, what happens to socialism? You know, in the case of, it seems like these, arguably, one could say, these are like incompatible notions. I mean, is it a cat, is it a dog? You can't have it both ways.
Oh, yeah, you can. Yeah, that's the mistake. Now, you've really got to think dialectically about this. You can't have it both ways. You can have both markets and you can have socialism. And there have been, in fact, the pressures to experiment with markets were there in Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union, and so on. Because it's clear that kind of central planning didn't work. You needed these kind of market incentives. Now, that whole experiment, I think, got short-circuited.
So coming out the other side, though, what do we have? I mean, we're looking at basically the reintroduction of market cap. I mean,
well, because for one thing you had, you know, you first of all, the breakup of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union came at the high point of neoliberalism. Neoliberalism was already, you know, on the upsurge because the regulated capitalism and so on had led to stagflation and so on. We had to deregulate. So that idea of this very attractive new model, neoliberalism was the new model out there supposedly, and your top Harvard economists, Jeffrey Sachs and company, were descending on there, telling them how to reorganize their economy, just privatize everything, just let the market do its magic. That's a formula for a disaster, okay? You know, on the other end, I think the initial experiments of trying to introduce, now remember, creating a socialist society, you know, is a complicated thing, and you're not going to get it right the first time, you know. You know, the experiment with central planning, I think we can see now why that didn't work. The experiments in Eastern Europe with the markets, where that ran into trouble, but I think the problems there weren't so much the market problems. You know, you had the fact that they were under the thumb of the Soviet Union, there was the nationalism that said, we don't want that anymore, and then when we knew what we didn't want that old system. We didn't know what we did want, you know, so let the Westerners come in, they're the smart people, let them tell us how to do things. You got, you know, a formula for disaster. I think what's going on in China, Vietnam, is much more interesting. Granted, you know, there's a lot of ugly things going on there, but on the other hand, an attempt, a huge complicated attempt, to try to create a society that does use markets, but at the same time still somehow stays socialist. This is not easy because you're unleashing all kinds, especially in a very poor country. There aren't any models out there to go by. You're trying to create something new. That's why I think you're seeing it there. You're seeing it in Venezuela, you know, where we've got a new form of socialism. We're going to have, you know, some democratic workplaces, more cooperation. Chavez isn't saying eliminate the market, you know. I know we tried that in Soviet Union. That isn't going to work. How do we do that? And I think, you know, it's difficult to figure out, but I think structurally, it's pretty clear what we have to do. You got to democratize workplaces, and we know those can work, you know. Not always, we got to figure out the details and how to structure those things, but there are a lot of successful examples, so we know that can be done. We know how markets work, what their problems are, and how they can be regulated. We know it's possible to get some kind of control over capital and allocate these. So I think we can see what has to be done, you know, in order to do this. And I think we can actually see the actual experiments of the world pointing in those directions. You know, they know there's something wrong. Neoliberalism didn't work, you know. The centrally planned socialism didn't work. We've got to have something else that is going to work. And I think something like economic democracy is the thing that could work. Something like that.
Okay, I see like seven hands up. I don't know.
True number.
Yeah, let's just, if you want to talk, raise your hand, please. Okay, there's a lot. Okay, keep track. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Did you get a number? Yeah. Did you get a number? Okay, nine, ten. Anyone else want in? Okay, do you all know what number you picked? I hope so. One.
I'm one.
Go ahead, please.
Let me say that I'm very glad...
And speak loudly, please.
I'm glad you're allowing me to speak. Unfortunately, what I'm hearing seems to be a great deal of hogwash vis-a-vis Animal Farm. But let me bring up the first point. Number one, you're relying on councils. Councils are people. People are bribable. Unfortunately, in oligarchy, whether you subdivide it into many, many different sections or keep it as a single oligarchy, such as was the case in the Soviet Union, which was primarily the plastic bureaucracy, it does not work. Until you take into account the foibles and the peculiar needs or wants even of people, it isn't going to work. You cannot depend entirely upon altruism.
Okay.
Altruism works for a while.
Yep.
Unfortunately, it doesn't work forever.
Right.
So you're going to have to add somebody kicking somebody in the ass. number two, information flow. Information flow. The really serious problem is that we are not in a static situation. Markets, or whatever you want to call it, is in a state of constant change, mainly chaotic change, which means to some degree unpredictable. Okay, how the hell do you get all of the information? Do you people know enough about astronomical
that question?
Wait a minute, let me get to what I'm talking about. If you are doing this in such a way that you're using an insufficient amount of information, you will be making enormous mistakes. Those mistakes on the basis of 6 billion people on the planet could be disastrous, and it doesn't take very large mistakes in order to make that an impossible situation. Third point, and this is probably going to have to be my last one, is one of medium of exchange.
Okay.
Medium of exchange in this world, regardless of what the quote economies are, for individual nation states, if there is such a thing anymore, is a very serious problem. These things are controlled. They're controlled in such a way that I don't think the individual members of a society, expand that to a nation state, really have control of those aspects.
Mm-hmm.
Since you do not, you will not determine what an equitable rate is.
Okay. May I respond to your three excellent points? I'd like to raise them each briefly in turn. And I can actually address one of the points with another one of your points that you raised,
okay,
the issue of medium of exchange. You will note that I did not ever say in my presentation medium of exchange,
right,
because participatory economics, strictly speaking, doesn't have it. There isn't it. The idea is that you're submitting a plan on the basis of indicative information. We'll talk about the information flow point in a moment. You're basically, you know, you're submitting a plan, you've got some list of what you think, and it doesn't mean you have to go into hyper detail. I mean, like, who here uses the Firefox web browser? Okay, who here has, of those of you who have you ever looked at the code of a rendering engine? I think you made my point, two people. You can, since it's an open source application, look at the code of how it works.
Yes, of course.
Do you? Do you? Aside from like three hands of the whatever, 20 or so, you don't have to. That doesn't mean you couldn't. For most people, they just say, I want a good web browser that works. Fine. Here it is. Merry Christmas. Same thing with this issue. You could go into hyperactive detail on every consumption detail that you want, but most people don't want to have to say two all beef patty, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions, and a sesame seed bun. They just want to say Big Mac and get the same thing. There are ways to simplify that issue regarding, and that it brings up to the second point, information flow. Yes, of course there are going to be issues about that. Yes, that there will be imperfections and that you're not going to be right. But remember that within market context, and this is one issue that hasn't been raised, that of the issue of externalities. Points regarding markets. Markets ignore externalities about the consumption, about, well, I mean, well, the classic example.
Ecology.
It can be positive too. You can do something that's a positive externality. But in the fact that our ICE, you know, we're all driving fossil fuel powered cars, that the externalities of that are ignored, and as a result, you know, Florida's gonna flood in the next 20 years. That's a negative externality. A pretty serious issue that isn't accounted for now, and I fear probably won't be accounted for in any subsequent market situation. So, brief response to that.
Okay, quick on that externality issue, because it's important. The point here is, of course, there are externality problems with markets. That's why the markets have to be regulated. There's nothing, in fact, it's perfectly reasonable in an economic democracy to say, yeah, you got an ecological problem, fossil fuels are, put a tax on that damn thing. That's what you got to do, so make it more expensive. In fact, there's nothing you can do in Paracon to regulate about externalities, positive or negative, that you can't do under economic democracy. Yes, you don't just let the markets run without any concern. Everybody knows that. All economists know that. There are externalities. There are ways of dealing with those externalities. They involve taxes and subsidies. We can do that.
To briefly address, that's the point of bribability. Since there's no medium of exchange, there's not really an easy way you can bribe people. At least I might think.
There was a number two.
Yeah, number two. Yo, Dave.
We'll have to try to make them short. We've got 10 people with their hands up.
Yeah.
Just in the interest of long-winded questions, you know, breeding anti-intellectualism, I'm going to keep this kind of blunt. Basically, all right, you mentioned China. Venezuela is sort of like new economic models up and coming right now. China, as far as I'm concerned, is a really bad example, because what China, in my mind, is doing is watching what we do, taking it, they're going to do it better. Worst case scenario, they're going to be the designer nation, we're going to be the producer nation. Venezuela, they're buying up all kinds of interests in oil companies and unsustainable resources and those kind of things. Chavez, I don't trust him. The guy's been given like all kinds of power, unquestioned power, in much the same way that Bush has over the last 5 years. And quite frankly, he's a politician, so I'm not going to trust him. You know, you don't trust anyone with absolute power.
All right.
My point, though, is these are all economic models, and what they sound like to me is top-down models, which personally I'm not a big fan of. And I think you're leaving out a lot about the great entropic disaster that the Earth is headed towards. If we keep working with these economic models, one messes up, we pick up another one. Oh, guess what? It's still all based on monetary gain. It's still based on capital, whether you call it capitalism or not. And there's always going to be some guy who's going to figure out a way to make more money with less effort. You're going to end up with like hegemonic, you know, authoritarian tendencies every single time. Where is the ecology of that? Where is the concern with, like, the big picture, the survival of the species?
Well, yeah, but my point is, you're going to have an economy, you know, whether we got global warming or not. It's not like, well, let's all concentrate on the ecology. We won't eat anymore. We won't wear any clothes anymore. We don't need any houses anymore. That's all got to be dealt with. There's got to be an economy. And is it necessarily top-down? Not necessarily top-down. Economic democracy is not top-down. It's democratic. Workers make decisions. You elect representatives that have to make decisions and so on. There have to be decisions made. There have to be laws passed and so on and so forth. There's no way around that. Now, the question is, which economic system is compatible with sustainability? I argue that capitalism isn't, because it's got to keep growing. It's got to keep growing. Economic democracy does not have to keep growing. Worker enterprises don't keep getting bigger and bigger. People don't have to keep consuming more and more. One of the things about a democratic firm is you can say, let's work less instead of consuming more.
let's, you know, use our productivity to have more free time. That's available to you in a democratic, you know, enterprise. It's not available to you in a capitalist enterprise. Capitalism is going to say, yeah, why don't you guys just work 30 hours instead of 40, you know, pay the same. They're not going to do that, you know. Under capitalism, you only make money when you're selling more, okay? That's not true under economic democracy. You've got to have a system that doesn't require steady expansion growth. And you're going to have politics. It's nice to say, all this is politics. All of, guess what, folks? If you're going to change the world, there's going to be politics. You're going to have something going on. You're going to have to win some power. You're going to have to make some elections. And yes, there's going to have to be leaders. And yes, there's going to have to be laws. That's the only hope you've got to solve the problems we're facing.
Just really quick, what do you tell all those people that are out of jobs because they were in marketing, advertising, and all the things that our current model of capitalism kind of thrives on?
Well, you're going to have to make that transition. You're going to have to be committed to providing full employment. You're going to have to say, well, we've got control over investment. We're going to find things for you guys to do. We're taking responsibility for that. We're not just going to throw you out in the cold. Yeah, you're not going to like it, maybe this job, but we're going to have to do certain sorts of things, you know, and we're not going to let you just fall through, you know, which you do under capitalism. You try to make any kind of reforms like that, the losers just fall through, you know. Of course they're going to be resentful. Of course they're going to struggle against that, but, you know, this other model isn't like that.
Number three.
It seems to be that what came out is that we're talking about how people are actually going to respond and react given a certain kind of structure, whether it's economic, and only now are we only touching on any kind of political structure that would support those kind of economic changes that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems that we need to talk more. I would be much more interested in hearing an honest admission about how people will act in given a certain situation, given a certain structure, economic and political.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's say, well, here's the good that can come out of it, but also say, what kind of behaviors will people regress to given a certain situation? Will there be more sloth given the fact that there's all this planning and talking? Yeah, but will other benefits outweigh that? You know, that kind of cost-benefit analysis would be helpful instead of saying, oh, and by the way, given all these institutions, I guess people will be the actors. I mean, given our psychology and given the fact that we have studies and studies and studies about how we will react in given certain situations, none of that, I don't see any of that information. I would love, that is, I think, a missing piece,
okay,
given all of this.
Let me give you a piece of
it. I'd like to also respond.
Global, and okay, so all this sounds very domestic,
right?
Like what's going to happen in our country, mm-hmm. especially you touched a little bit upon this. Well, we're going to have tariffs and so we can protect ourselves. Well, what about folks in Africa? I mean, there is a historical legacy here that we have created. We are responsible. So what happens with that?
What happens with that is what happens. You know, this idea of how people react is very important. For example, greatly in a democratic workplace, we've got lots of studies on those because there's lots of them out there. And we know, for example, people do work hard. Work, you know, they don't require as much supervision because you don't have, as someone was talking about, you know, the regression, you know, problem. Because in a democratic firm, you benefit, you know, because your income is specifically tied to how well you do. So you don't need so many foreman monitoring and everything like that because your well-being and the well-being of the larger enterprise are a lot more congruent than they are under capitalism. Also, you've got the system as a whole has a lot more security. You're not threatened with losing your job, you know, and if you do, you've got full employment and so on and so forth. And my sense is, what are you going to do about Africa? Lots of problems, okay? What can you do, okay? Well, my sense is a secure population, a population that isn't so terrified and insecure as our own population is a lot more likely to say, well, what can we do, you know, that would really help there? One thing we're not going to say is, well, just give them a lot of money, because clear money isn't the problem. You know, we can say, okay, let's use some of our research facilities to start talking about alternative appropriate technologies. Let's invite people to our universities to get the education that they need. Let's find out what people need there. Talk to them. Let them decide. You know, that's another advantage of this kind of economic democracy. It doesn't require that every society have the same standard of living. There's not that global equalizing consumer culture out there, you know. And in fact, in many ways,
in order to become a sustainable society, we're going to have to make a lot more changes than a lot of poor countries would have to make, because they're not consuming, they're not polluting at the level that we are. So we will help with what we can. But you've got to ask yourself, what do poor countries need that we have, okay? And start asking that question concretely, you know. Well, but you've got to ask the people there, and they've got to decide these sorts of things. You know, we can't impose them. We can't set up a structure that says this is what you all have to do. Okay, that's my answer.
I'd like to give a couple of responses to the 2 points regarding, I guess, how do people react in real-life situations regarding participatory economics and the international scope. In the issue of how do people react, we actually know a little something about this in the here and now. There are, and actually Carl had touched on this, a number of institutions that are building themselves on Paricon-ish models, most notably ZNet and Z Magazine, South End Press, a website called The New Standard, online at newstandardnews.net, which is an online news and information website. There are a small handful of cooperatives in Winnipeg in Canada, that are also most notably the G7 and the Mondragon Collective, not to be confused with the Mondragon Cooperative in Spain. But there are some businesses where this happened. I spoke with Jessica Azoulay at the New Standard about talking about some of her experiences in the last almost 3 years now of how they've been doing stuff there. And it turns out that the motivation problem and the psychology is very different than what you find in practically any other, or very few, maybe the Paricon, other Paricon examples are another example of it. It's very different. Just to briefly outline how they do it at the New Standard, because it's very instructive. They basically divide up all of work that goes on at the New Standard into more or less 4 categories. Content production, so you're editing stuff, researching and writing stuff, or software development, content. There's also administrative work, like, you know, paying the bills, keeping the books, responding to phone calls, responding to emails. There's also administrative personnel decisions, like who gets hired, who gets fired, things like that. And there's also a category called conmin, which they call content slash administrative. Those tasks which are really empowering, but also really onerous, and a lot of people want to avoid those. And what they do is they try to balance their work tasks out in the course of things. And you discover in the course of things that, oh, Jessica seems to be taking on a lot more administrative tasks. Maybe I can help out by doing some more of my own. You'll discover that the solidarity comes out fairly quickly, at least at the New Standard and probably at other places as well, where this has been implemented. On the question about, so I think that's actually very instructive, and this might be something to try to replicate in our own institutions elsewhere, and certainly in Chicago and maybe elsewhere beyond. On the question of international affairs, Paricon handles that. The pat answer is what's referred to as the 50% rule. Say you've got a fairly wealthy Paricon economy and a much poorer, less so. The Paricon economy would basically say any benefits that would accrue beyond 50% go to the poorer country. That would help to reduce the income gap between the two, and as a result also help to raise that standard of living within the poorer country itself. This is described in some depth actually in this book, Economic Justice and Democracy by Robin Hanel. You may want to check that out.
Just a side comment. I mean, it's 4:12. I don't know how. I mean,
yeah.
I'm happy.
We're
to
at
stay,
question
but,
four.
You know, yeah, I don't want people. To
We're at that. Question
they want
to go,
four. Waiting for us to get shot.
Okay. Okay, four. Yes, sir.
How do you democratize the workplace, and what is there an example in this country? I mean,
yeah, there are actually a lot of worker-run enterprises. How do you democratize a workplace? Okay, one way is the workplace is started, the new enterprise is started up as a cooperative, as a producing cooperative.
Well, let's just say that's already.
A hospital is already, I mean, one way, in fact, it's sometimes thought about. You've got a capitalist enterprise that was started by an individual. This person is ready to retire. You know, his heirs don't want to take it over or anything. You can set this up so that the workers themselves can buy it out, you know. And then they set up a worker council, and they decide to elect, you know, who the managers are going to be, and so on and so forth. That's the standard model is to have some kind of worker buyout, you know. And sometimes, if you had a government that was sympathetic to that, you could provide financing so that they could provide financing to the workers that would repay over time till you become the owners, you know, of the company. And not only owners, but
have democratic authority, one person, one vote, you know, on running the company. Now, one person, one vote on a big company doesn't mean everybody votes on everything. That's another thing I realize. You know, democracy has also is going to involve a certain amount of hierarchy. You're going to have a council that's going to appoint the management. But the point about democracy, the strength of democracy is, you know, you don't have to have the expertise to make all the decisions, but usually you can see when things are screwing up. And so you have the ability to get rid of managers that are incompetent. Okay? And that's why, and there's lots of studies of these cooperatives and so on, plywood cooperatives in the Pacific Northwest, they tend to be more efficient. They tend to be more efficient because we always think capitalism is so efficient. But actually, a lot of capitalist countries are not efficient at all. They go bankrupt and they, you know, take their workers with them. And very often, the workers, they already knew that ahead of time. They could see this company wasn't being run. But there's nothing, you know, that they can do about it, you know. So this isn't the panacea. It doesn't say worker-owned enterprises always work, you know. They're all there. But compared to capitalist enterprises, I don't know of a single study out there that shows that democratically run firms in comparable industries do worse. And they almost always do worse.
How is it democratic if managers run the business?
Because you can throw them out. I mean, see, this is another thing. It's another problem with paraconning. It's not even empowering work. The idea versus unempowering work. Like, those people in management have all the power, and the rest of us are just doing the shit work, you know? Well, actually, in enterprises, a lot of those managers, it's not fun being a manager. In fact, one of the problems you've got in enterprises is how to get competent people to be managers, you know? Because you've got to make a lot of decisions, you've got to please the people above you, you've got to say hard things to the people below you. This isn't fun, it's empowering. Well, it's empowering in the sense that you can tell other people what to do, but is this, you know, a lot of fun to work in a place like that? You know, not necessarily, you know, and in fact, you know, you want your good managers to be people that have enough. First of all, if you're going to be a good manager, you've got to have a certain kind of autonomy, a certain sense that I can make decisions, I don't have to worry about it. Every time I make a decision, somebody's going to complain. We're going to have to be tied up in committee. We're not going to get anything done. You've got to give a certain autonomy to managers so they can manage well, but keep ultimate authority. If they start screwing up, you can get rid of it, you know, and elect people that will do a better job. That idea, and this is empirically the issue with worker-owned enterprises, figuring out how to get that balance, how to keep democratic control at the bottom, but still get quality managers and giving them enough incentive, and it's not necessarily monetary incentive, although that's usually part of it. You pay them more because they got more responsibility. You know, but also, you know, the job itself, you feel like there's something you can accomplish there. You go into a job, you know, and you feel like, geez, I can't get anything done there. You know, just let things coast. You know, that's not the kind of management you want. And it makes a huge difference, though, I think, whether those managers ultimately are responsible to the workforce at the bottom, or, as it is in a capitalist firm, the managers are responsible to the stockholders. Now, the stockholders only have one interest. You know, we want maximum return. Okay? That's all. Okay? Whereas workers, Matt, we want the company to do well, we want our income, but we also want our conditions to work to be reasonable, you know, and we also want some leisure time, and you've got those kinds of things that you can ask for, and you can see that your managers provide those, and if they don't, you know, get rid of them.
Can't you manage your own workplace, though?
What's that?
Can't you manage your own workplace, though?
Imagine workplace, maybe if there's five of you at South End Press, you know, if there's 5,000 of you, you know, what do you do? If there's,
well,
you know,
I can explain. What
well,
do you do?
I mean, you got to have some hierarchy.
No, you don't.
How do you run out? Okay, you get 5,000.
All right, I'll tell you. Actually, and this is a great question.
We got 2,000.
Go back to this actually addresses your question regarding democratizing the workplace. The key institution here is balance for desirability and empowerment. And you've got, let's say, a firm, 5,000 workers. Well, how do you gauge for desirability? Well, that's easy. You set up the list of whatever the jobs are. Try to take a look at how many applications you get for each respective job. If they're more or less equal, I mean, there'll be obviations, of course, you've more or less achieved. If you're discovering pretty serious disparities where there are some jobs which are hugely desirable, the number of applications is just through the roof, and others which hardly any, or maybe none, that's pretty clear. If you find that, the solution is simple. Do it again until such time as you get that more or less even desirability. For empowerment, it's a lot harder because it's always a judgment call. you can't really tell offhand. You could probably over time using from something like a sociological study about whether or not people who are participating in a workplace are actually, engaged in meaningful work and then able to contribute to the overall circumstances of a workplace. That's a lot harder. But nonetheless, I think there's a key question here about, are you striving a job environment where that's at least an ideal and are taking steps to achieve that? Or do you want Walmart?
Now, see, I think here's this shows kind of a difference in the way we're thinking about this. Paracon seems to me you've got this, in a sense, top-down formula. This is how you're going to do it. We're going to look at these applicants, and we're going to see how many we want, and we're going to redo. My workplace democracy, you say, okay, do we want to redesign jobs in such a way? How do people want to do it? You know, do we want... to pay some people more than others.
In the case,
do it. You know, it's up to you. We're not going to try to say we've got this thing. We got to make sure these job complexes are balanced, that they're all equally empowered. You know, organize it the way you want. Okay,
that's exactly what participatory realm models that exist now do. You'll compare like ZNet and South End Press and the new standard.
They're
doing yet. Well, I mean, they're not perfectly such, but nonetheless, they're at least striving for, and their implications of things like balanced job complexes, they handle themselves.
Well, but that's what I'm saying. That's a democratic. Any democratic workforce does that.
Okay.
You can say it's an example of Paragon, or you can say it's an example of economic.
Well, it's not perfectly such because it's in the market system.
Workplaces do allow for that.
And then two, it's not what was just mentioned. I think it's the fact that we have different definitions of what's democratic.
Well,
so we're talking about definitions of democratic. We could talk about, okay, well, we might as well just have workplaces run like Congress.
This issue is important one. Because in one of my responses to Albert, I talk about, there's a problem with the democracy solves the problem, participatory democracy. You don't realize that there can be democratic alienation. If you're just democratic, everyone's going to feel it. Have you ever been in a democratic institution, been on, say, at a university where you've got a faculty council, you get that? These things are you get to talk about a lot of things, okay? And that's good. I mean, I think it's better to be in a Democrat, but don't think everyone's going to be happy because they're not. You're democratic, you lose the vote, you feel bad, you figure there's too many meetings, I got better things to do, this is a waste of time. All of those things throw up. My idea here is democracy is valuable, but you've got to not overload the system. If you try to ask too many people to decide too many things, it breaks down. You want to keep the issues that need to be decided, through democratic discussion and vote, relatively small. Most people, in fact, don't want to be involved in all those things. Most people want to just live their lives and not have to worry about this stuff. And Paragon says, well, you don't have to fill out these lists if you don't want to. Well, then how are people going to know what you want? Well, they'll just guess, They'll just tell you, what you're... And you're not going to have any money. They're just going to tell you, okay, you get this many eggs and this many gallons of milk. No. How are you going to know? You say you don't have money. What do you do? Does it all get dropped off at your doorstep in a box every week?
I can explain some of the details, but we've got six more people on the queue with some questions. Number five?
Yeah.
Five. We're at five.
I know we're towards the end.
Yeah, and people are getting restless.
We kind of pass right over this question of the previous socialist countries. And the reason I would like each one of you to speak to that is that I think it is important to know that history and to actually go against some of the versions of it that are in school today. So I do think studying the real history of the socialist economies that have existed and looking at, nobody's mentioned the Chinese experience, which each time there has been a socialist revolution, they've gone and looked at what went before, and I think it's incumbent on us to do the same. If we're going to have, and I love the way that we're having spurious debate over the society that we would want to live in, but if we're going to have that, I think this question of what that would look like, we should look at those historical experiences and not just, it was a very classical, the centralized planned economy. What they tried to do in China was something different. And I don't want to take your time to do that lecture, there's other people that do that better, but I think that asking the questions about the previous experience, learning their positive accomplishments as well as learning a good critique of the shortcomings and mistakes is an important thing right now for activists to do. And I'm on projects at the Record Straight that is involved in doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say I absolutely agree. And in fact, I usually argue Marx actually did not provide a blueprint, and I argue he shouldn't because there wasn't any
data to go on back there in terms of how you would organize a post-capitalist society. We're not in that situation. There have been enormous experiments, you know, with the Soviet Union, with China, with Vietnam, with Eastern Europe, with Cuba. We know a lot more now, you know, about what works and what doesn't work. And I actually try to, you know, draw those implications. I think one of the things we know now is that you do need some kind of market, you know. Among other things, you do need a certain kind of decentralization and figuring out how to democratize things properly. But you can see that getting control over investment is a positive sort of thing. I think we also kind of know that, you know, at least in an advanced society, the transition is going to have to be, you know, you're going to have a different model of how you're going to have a transition, because you're not going to have a kind of revolution that you had in Russia or China. You're not going to have peasant armies in the Appalachians seizing Washington. You know, you're going to have to think, or storming the White House. There's a lot of things, but there's a lot of things we know now. You know, what worked and what didn't work, and not only in socialist countries, but also in capitalist countries. There's been a lot of reform attempts and so on. Well, what worked? What didn't work? Why didn't they work? And I think out of all of that, I paid a lot of attention to this. You know, studied a lot about Yugoslavia and China and so on and so forth. And I think you get something like economic democracy is the sort of basic picture of what you would need to work, that takes into account the advantages of being able to plan investment and so on, you know, as well as the need for certain kinds of motivation, for efficiency that you didn't have, you know, in certain kinds of models, you know, and I think you're going to get something like that. But that history is very important.
I don't want to belabor the discussion too much, but the history is important because we've seen in past economies, in the course, I'll just focus on the 20th century, that they don't, you know, promote solidarity, efficiency, equity, diversity, self-management. And we hope that, on drawing on lessons not only in theory but in practice, why that's the case, that something else has to call into play. And I presented one model of what I think will try to achieve that. And also is brought up on some experience, some in within the realm of historical experience, but also within personal experience. Like South End Press had tried to implement something like balanced job complexes before the formal model of participatory economics was formalized and written up. I'll leave it at that. We're at question six. Yes, sir.
I just have a question for both of your models. Mm-hmm. First one is for Pericon. If we are to plan, for example, for our needs like 1 year in advance, mm-hmm. Theoretically, mm-hmm. Let's say like 2 months from now I get a cough, mm-hmm. and I did not, you know, plan for cough syrup.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a great question.
I die of cough. So I mean, how? Or let's say like a hurricane comes and, you know, destroys New Orleans.
Right.
And the people there did not plan for like emergency like batteries. How are they going to get that?
Okay.
Okay. And,
yeah.
It's a question for your model. And I mean, democratic workplaces sound awesome. They sound awesome within democratic workplaces. But let's say we have like a really a collective who makes like really good peanut butter, and sooner or later they tend to accumulate wealth that in the end, eventually along a period of time, you end with like a or a very rich collective compared to other collectives. So they're good within themselves, but as a compared to other collectives, they're a lot richer. And how does your system do that?
Okay, I'll start. I'll do you one better. Suppose I break my arm. I'm in a participatory economy. I've already made my plan. And then a month into the plan of that year, I break my arm. But I can't predict that in advance, so I can't plan that in advance. So what do you do? Well, in the case of an individual breaking a particular arm, yeah, you can't predict that. You could, however, predict that on the level of larger societal trends. So that would actually be planned for, like the supplies necessary for healing broken arms would be planned for at, say, a city level. So that you'd be able to determine those kinds of trends of how many broken bones did you have in the course of a year. Well, we'll figure we'll probably have more. So we'll probably increase, account for that, maybe plan for a little bit more of what's termed slack as a result of that. So that's one way to address that. On the matter regarding a hurricane, yeah, suppose there's a tornado coming, and you're a tornado survival specialist. Does that mean that we all have six meetings and you know, try to figure out some equitable plan, or do we put you in charge to help us survive? There will be times when we'll need a kind of power arrangement where, for the sake of survival, one person may have to call the shots. The point of Paracon, where in instances like that where you'll need to have some, to basically put things like self-management aside for the sake of basic survival, you can dispense that. The point, though, there is that in the longer term, when there isn't that necessary survival issue, what would you want to have as a good economy and the effects of that? It doesn't necessarily mean that you absolutely have to have, you know, balance for desirability and empowerment at every point within the course of every lifespan. There will be times when you'll be doing onerous stuff or not so onerous stuff, or will you have a disproportionate say over the impacts of others? But the point there is, how is that impacted over the course of larger stretches of time and the consequences as a result of that?
Okay, the peanut butter question, you know, is a nice one. You know, partly, you want your enterprises to try to produce really good peanut butter. So, you know, so, you want them to be rewarded. They've got something people like that better than the alternative, and so they do well, better than, you know, the competitive peanut butter makers. But what's going to happen? Well, those other peanut butter makers, first of all, are going to say, what are they doing? You know, let's figure out their formula. Let's do what they are doing. You know, so you're going to have an incentive to figure that out. Okay. Also, you don't want, as a peanut butter collective, you don't want your orders to double and triple and so on, because that means, what, are you going to have to work twice, three times as long? Or you're going to have to hire more people, bring more people in? You know. So it's all right if some other, we want to use this advantage for a while to feel better, you know, but, you know, we want more peanut butter gets produced, so other companies are going to start making it. Other enterprise, it requires a new technology. You've got your public banks, and your other peanut butter company goes, hey, we need an upgrade. You know, give us a loan so that we can upgrade our facility to be like theirs, and you'll get the loan. Okay.
Well, I mean, if we have a rich peanut butter collective, they don't really need the loan.
No, the rich ones don't, but the poor ones do. Exactly. You know, and so they can get access to the public banks that are supposed to be giving out money for companies that want to upgrade their technology and so on and so forth and produce a better product. That's why you give those people the loan. Why did they want it? Because they can sell more peanut butter and be able to pay back the loan. So it works that way.
Another note, though, is that if I want to create more peanut butter, it doesn't necessarily follow that I have to hire more people. I just have to keep my machines running longer.
Well, if you got better, with somebody to be there to watch the machines, unless it's fully automated.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, the other competitors are going to want those machines too, and they're going to go to their local community banks and say, give us a loan, you know, so we can do that. And yeah, that's what we do. Because the community banks don't want this peanut butter company to go bankrupt, so yeah, they'll give them a loan to try to, you know.
Well, the thing is, I can still actually go to the public bank and still say, I'm the rich collective. I can still go to the public bank and say, hey, give me, so then I end up with twice the amount of money that the poor collective.
Well, as I say, that's why you've got social control of investment. The banks giving out are weighing the general needs of the community and so on, and making judgments about that.
Yeah, we're at number seven. Sorry, that sounds like a bureaucrat. What?
Seven.
Speak loudly, please.
Yeah, there's so many levels of committees and councils in Paracon. We've actually created a system of bureaucratic anarchism. It's amazing to me. The idea that you're talking about, you don't have a government, you've created an anarchist state. I mean, the idea that you can estimate how many broken arms there are going to be in Chicago for an health plan goes beyond the style of central planning.
Hang on. We've got two people who want to respond.
Online, you can find how many arms have been broken in Chicago, in Boston, in New York, in Spain, they'll give it. They'll tell you how many children have died from heart diseases. This is collected.
I'd like to... Hang on.
Jerry's supposed to be asking a question, too.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, there's so many meetings in your conception of society.
No.
It's this intellectual left culture. People do other things than me.
That's right.
They go fishing, they hang out with their family, sure. They write poetry.
Bingo.
It's like the Cultural Revolution on steroids.
Can I respond? The point is, well, here's what I would say with that response. You're setting up this structure in order to better account for things that past structures haven't done or in such ways with onerous results. And the point here is to make a comparison between, I think the example between markets and participatory economy is clear in that, use the example of what's termed a zero-sum game. In a market economy, you can succeed basically at the expense of someone else. Here in the participatory economy, the point is, do we all succeed or do we all fail? So we should all set up this arrangement so that we all succeed. And also arrange for the institutions, balance job complexes, remuneration for effort and sacrifice, and to achieve at what we hope is a viable society-wide allocation plan. These are all things we all want. And as a result, we would want to try to achieve those things so that we can all get along. Brief response.
I was just going to say on the whole planning for broken arms thing, why in the hell wouldn't you plan for broken arms? Like, we have a hospital without a broken arm and no one's there to give you any stuff to fix it.
Wait. We got, aren't we going in order? You know.
We just briefly responded. You wanted to have a brief response. Okay, number 8. Yes, sir.
The thing coming, you know, right now, it seems as though we're losing the means of production in this country. We've lost a lot of jobs. China now has the means of production. In a sense, we're becoming like England was. We're going to be the second-rate power. That's number one. Number two, just read recently, New York Times last Friday, in an article, currency, that in euros, they have more bonds in euros than they do in dollars. Now that's a tipping point. Now the New York Times put it, well, maybe within a generation or 50 years we'll have a real problem. Maybe the euro will be stronger and the dollar will be out. But Der Spiegel, which is a German paper, they reported about a week ago along the same lines. They figure within about less than 5 years we're going to have a currency crisis. Or a currency catastrophe, if you will, because our debt is into the trillions, and people invest money in this country based on our ability to pay it back, and they're reaching the point, and then the euro is the example of not believing that we have the capacity to pay it back, and that's the fact. And if that happens, we're in serious trouble. This is something to look at, and the other thing to look at is how to raise the labor costs in China. Because if we can't do that, we can't compete.
Okay, well, that's not true. Like, for one thing, you can put a tariff on and say, hey, you can.
Well, that doesn't work either, because then your corporations raise the prices.
No. I'm sorry. That's not the way it works, you know. But also, if there's a currency, there may well be a crisis, you know, but let's keep in mind this peculiarity of financial crisis. It was like the Great Depression, the stock market collapse. Why did that throw the economy into 10 years, you know, of despondency and huge unemployment? Keep in mind, if there's a currency crisis, you still got all the people, you still got all your skills, you still got all your means of production, you still got all your resources, you still got all your land, all of that's there, okay? This is precisely the kind of situation that says, we got to do something different, okay? We can't just let the real economy collapse because some speculators, you know, did this craziness, okay? Do what Roosevelt did. You know, you say, okay, close all the banks, you know, we're going to reorganize the finance, you know, only let's do it this time. I mean, okay, let's say, okay, let's democratize our firms. Let's take all those bankrupt corporations, you know, turn them over to the workers. Let them run. They're still there. They still got all the skills. The people that need those things, they're still there, you know. You know, we could solve the fundamental problem that way. You don't have to, you know, think that because there's a currency crisis, the world is over. It's not over. Or the United States is declining in power. We're not a big deal. Britain declined in power. Does that mean the Brits are starving to death? You know, they're living in hovels, you know, or something like that? Big deal, you decline. You're not the dominant economic power anymore. You could still have a decent, humane, viable, better than we've got now kind of economy. Yeah, get used to it. The United States is not going to be the world power economically, you know, a decade or so from now, or 20, however long it's going to take. But that doesn't have to be something we're terrified about. Oh my God, what are we going to do if we're not number one? Hey, guess what? Every other country in the world isn't number one, you know, and a lot of them are living a lot better than we are. So,
we're at number 9. Yeah. Yes, sir. No, gentleman behind you. Yeah, yeah, okay. You. Number nine.
My question is kind of covered, but I think to an outsider of Paracon, I've never really heard about it. Mm-hmm. The list, I think, rubs people, you know, the wrong way sometimes.
Okay.
So we have the unforeseen Hurricane Katrina, but also just, I mean, is there information will never probably be perfect, but is there some idea that there will be some bartering or some black market would pop up, because just in the sense that, you know, hey, I've got these three pairs of shoes, I only use one, I can get something for the shoes or tweezers or anything, or this week I want 4 eggs, next week I need 14 eggs. I mean, just those kind of spontaneous things that come up, and how you account for that, or what's envisioned about that, or, you know.
In various descriptions about the model that have been shown regarding markets, they basically wiped out. You don't have markets. The idea is that you're to, you know, make some kind of reasonable, I'm actually trying to sketch this out in terms of a role-playing game. So if you actually wanted to see the details about how this would go out, you would have some contribution that you would make to some kind of, to the society. That contribution would come in the form of, you know, the hours you make, the kinds of tasks that you do, how onerous they are, the relative desirability of them, the empowerment effects as a result of them. You would then receive as a result numbers of, like basically it's termed as an effort rating, which is basically capped in order to prevent the objection actually that David raised regarding inflation of effort ratings. So that, you know, we just, those of us on this side of the room couldn't conspire against you guys in order to, you know, increase our benefit as a result. You basically prevent that from some kind of cap. That is then translated into a non-transferable credit that you then use in order to try to draw up a plan. Basically, where you're turning that credit to then use that credit to buy, in quotation marks, stuff that has indicative prices. And you're doing that over the course of some period of time, which can change over the course of a period of time if you break your arm or something. And then you submit that in. And if that works with what everyone else is submitting, then you're done. Chances are it's probably not going to happen. So then you would receive that back with additional information back. If you want to find out additional detail because you think that things are not going in a different way, you can. But you basically try to achieve that. The goal of the participatory planning procedure is to eliminate all excess demand. Once you've done that, you're done. Now, it could be the case, and actually David had also pointed this out, about having planned. Basically, we've hammered out 95% of the economy, and then we've got plans that we then arrive at, which we then vote on. You wouldn't have things to vote on until you've actually hammered out 95 or 97 or 99% of the economy. But if you wanted to reduce the number of iterations in order to get to 100%, you could set it up so that you've got some, so that the number of people, so that you, in order to try to hammer out the remaining 3 or 1 or 0.5%, you can do that by some small group, or perhaps involved with an iteration facilitation board, to basically then submit plans to try to achieve that. Now, this is basically how, in sketch detail, putting a little bit more meat on the bones that I had presented in my presentation. And you'll notice that there's no markets at all. And the point is to try to get rid of them, precisely because if you, having them there would not really be all that productive, because the motivations of a market, where you basically try to achieve at the expense of someone else, are eliminated in participatory economics, precisely because you're remunerated by the most fair way we can think of, remuneration per effort and sacrifice. That the various issues that go into play regarding the development of classes and trying to gain at the expense of someone else are eliminated. So I hope that answers your question.
It's a little bit different, because I think this is just sort of what I think just drives me nuts about Paracon. You know, it's like, first of all, you said there's not going to be money because you can't bribe people. Else. So, okay, you've got your list for a year. Okay, now I guess you get it back and stamp approved. You're entitled to 150 eggs this year. Okay, where are they going to come from? You're going to have to go to a distribution center.
Right.
Right. So you trot down to the distribution center. You show out. Look, I'm entitled to this. This is how many I've used. What if they say, we don't have any eggs, you know? Or what are their motives, you know? maybe we didn't, maybe they got sent to the wrong place, or maybe in the back room and I don't want to bring them out, you know. I mean, geez, this is a lot of work. And I mean, think about that, you know. You don't go in and pick things off the shelf and buy them. No, you show, this is what I'm entitled to, and you ask someone behind the desk, go get them for you. I mean, you know, have you ever been in Eastern Europe or something and they're trying to shop for something there? Like, Jesus, you know, this, they have no interest whatsoever in satisfying you or meeting you. The district, people working in the distribution center, you know, someone's going to be monitoring them saying, look, you know, you got to be keeping track of you, make sure you, you know, work efficiently and so on and so forth. Who's monitoring?
The plans that would have arrived at would have come before you get to the distribution center. The idea is that you'd be submitting. Well, hold on. But that list, however, would not have just, you know, happened de novo, sprung up out of nothing. You would have been in the course of negotiations between producers and consumers. Figure that out.
This is what you're entitled to. I'm just wondering, you're entitled to this. How are you going to get it? You know.
Yeah, briefly.
What I find kind of curious is that participatory economics, it's not a lot of fun to go into the allocation side of it, because we don't, as a culture, really go into allocation sides of any economy, really. I mean, none of us really know. Like, when you talked about going into a store and going and getting something, listen, there's been no talk of how things get produced in the economy you're talking about, except for that it's a market.
Do you know how things are produced?
Oh, we do.
Not a
wait a second. I don't think anybody in this room.
You don't know how eggs are produced. Good. You don't know farmers out there.
Wait a second. But that's no different than in another kind of economy. It's just the way in which you plan for it is different. Okay. So you can make it seem. The thinking behind participatory economics is so different in the sense that it doesn't use markets, and that's hard to comprehend. But just to say that a market makes all this other stuff happen without, like, all the talk of meetings, like, there aren't meetings in this economy. There are endless meetings in this economy. Endless meetings. There are people who go to meetings all day. All right? I mean, just because my aunt goes to meetings all day. That's what she does. She's a mid-level manager, and she just meets all day. But the point I'm trying to make here is that you can look at a model, but because the onus on this model is to sort of describe in detail how it works, doesn't mean that lets other models off the hook because you don't describe in detail how it works. Like, it's like deconstructing a model that does the same things another model does and just does it different.
We're at number 10, just to go back.
I'm number 10.
But were there?
Ask your question, then I'll ask mine.
Okay.
Oh, I thought we were all done.
Are we?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, number one. Anyone here go to Jewel to buy food? Dominant?
Sure.
Any of you guys have those cards?
Yeah.
Do you know they know? Oh, you don't. Okay. Well, a lot of people do. Yeah. Oh, you do. Okay. They know the date that you bought the food. They know what you bought. They have all the information, how much that weighed. A ton of information that you never see. But if I went into the Jewel computer, I could tell you what you weighed for the last year. So to collect that information is no problem. I don't see any problem with that. Number two, in our society, back in like 1997, 98, I think it was a Newsweek and Time, to come out and they say the U.S. has passed 80% of the purchases or the buying in the U.S. is not done with money. It's done either with a credit card, a check, some type of electronic transfer and stuff like that. And less than 20%, this includes the drug trade, I guess diamond trade that you're passing money, things like that. Goes on. So 80% of the information we have is at our fingertips, and you can look it up on a computer. These things about planning ahead, we already do that. Chicago buys a certain amount of salt for what we estimate the snow's gonna fall. Sometimes more snow falls and we'll have to buy salt. Because of global warming, we'll probably have to buy less salt. But that planning's done, and all societies do that. Now,
there's a difference.
Okay, there are some differences, but what I'm saying is that that information very easily accessible.
Let me just point out the jewel card thing. Yeah, you know, after people have bought things, you know, what they purchased. So they can tell you what you bought last year, but you are going to be required to say what you want for the coming year. You've got to list that out, and they can send you, here's the whole list of what you bought last year, and it's going to be a long list, man. It's going to take you a long time to go through that list. That's what you bought last year. Now, how do you want to change it for next year? You know, let's do. And then you're going to go to Jewel, and you're not going to say, this is what I want. You've got to have your list saying, this is what I'm allowed to buy, you know, at these prices, and you've got to show them. And if I'm allowed to buy this, because you know, it's on my list, it's been approved, so they give it to you. That's vastly, vastly more complicated than, you know, going in with your credit card, picking things off. Yeah, there's planning. There's going to be planning going on in any economy, but you don't want the planning to just overwhelm, you know, everything else, you know, to make it just crazy.
To respond back to that, there's always a certain amount of error, right? And like grocery stores are one of the best. They have it down to under like 2% of their losses. Like people didn't buy this product that went bad. They have that down to 2%, but most of it, because of the computer, been able to do that. It used to be like 8 or 9%. And having these cards allows them to do that because they can calculate what people buy, or even like in a certain neighborhood. Like I live in a Hispanic neighborhood. We have tons more Hispanic food in there that you won't find up on the north side. So they can specialize it. Now, Paracon and the Paracon book that's written is written for any society. So it can be written for some Eskimos up in Alaska where, yes, they won't be making that list. In a complex society like the U.S., I don't think it would go like that. And the majority of what people buy, we know what people buy in Chicago. I mean, I can make an estimate. I can bring it down to 98% of what people in Chicago are going to buy for the next year. We can make that calculation. Because you go, whether they bought, you look at the trend, information is accessible in any of the fields.
Is there going to be one big distribution store? Or are they all?
No, we'll have a soup. We'll have Jewel, and they'll have their own.
They'll have it all. They'll all have it there ready for you when you come in.
Yeah. Who uses a budget?
Who uses a budget? Does it have inputs? Do you have to assume what you're going to consume?
Yeah.
And you want 150 million households in the United States are all going to budget their money very carefully. Sure. They're all going to compile these lists, and they're all going to walk into Jewel, and they're all going to stand in line and show.
But what's the alternative?
The alternative is like, let's have a market. Let's make people.
And corporations run roughshod, and you've got central planning arrangements as a result. Yeah. Dictatorial points.
That's incredibly
Yeah.
That's nothing like filling out a list of everything you want to consume.
Maybe some people's personal taxes are, but a lot of people's are. That's why they have other people that do it. There's no saying that there couldn't be people that help you do this whole process. All right.
We've got,
starting to get too into this.
Why
don't we have questions now? There were two other things we haven't spoken before.
Yeah. Okay, wait a minute. There was just two other things I wanted to bring up. Yeah. All the social democracies that I've seen in Europe, or that have developed in Europe, there was strong social awareness in Europe for World War I, World War II, and in part, the U.S. got involved in Europe after World War II to fight off that socialist push. I don't see that here in the U.S. We have a different mentality here than they do in Europe. So your system can only work if 50% plus one
want to change.
Paracon can work like how the corporations did it, starting out with one corporation, another corporation, they begin to grow, and then they begin to organize themselves so they can control the government. A social democracy couldn't do that. It would have to be the 50 plus one. Wow, Paracon, we can begin working on it today and go building it up. And my last thing is...
I'm going to have to go soon, too. But also... People have
Yeah, sure. Quickly.
I just don't want to criticize one system or the other, but I would like to bring up the fact that we look at history. Somebody was mentioned looking at history. But remember that every time that we do a new environment, a new thing, everything is different. So we cannot count what we did in past history. And remember,
that from 1970, well, from the time I was born till now, what the population change have been? Mm-hmm. What the situation of the environment, the soil, the water, the contamination of everything, nuclear power, nuclear contamination, nuclear accidents, this is all totally different. So I don't know if we can even predict, if we have this problem here in debating this, imagine the shit we are in. We are not going to come out of this mess. We really have to start changing this, I think, what we demand of life to be satisfied and happy. If we start realizing that we don't need to be running in a, you know, in the middle all the time to satisfy extraneous desires created by Vanity Fair showing women showing their legs or their tits or something. I mean, when are we going to start demanding that we are respecting ourselves and each other? That's what we need to work on. And the systems we develop naturally around that. I think that's the solution there.
Let's go.
You know, I think...
Speak up, please.
I think you're very close to where I feel I am. By the way, this is a great session.
It took me a long time to learn it, too.
Same page in thinking it's not just enough to say you got to have a change of consciousness. You got to know what actual structures are you going to put in place that you know will enable that.
Nobody were selfish.
But that's not going to happen. Yeah. We're not going to have a situation where nobody is selfish. You know.
Governance, except on the basis of forcing the concept of generosity from one person to a neighbor. That's all.
Well, in the case, we should probably.
A religious freak or anything like that. I appreciate the value of religion. I think it's very important for what it is. But you guys are talking about control concepts on both sides. And lack of, you've got the one controlled economy, you've got the one less controlled economy, and sort of missing the point. All of these complex systems would be largely irrelevant if people were concerned about each other and the environment to the extent that they would control themselves.
Well, telling people to not be selfish, I think, would not be, well, that won't work plainly. So I'm thinking, actually, David is correct on the point that the context in which whether or not it's advantageous to be selfish or not is one key element about that. Now, in the case of a market economy, yeah, it is advantageous to be selfish. I'm a selfish pig, so I'm going to set up some kind of, you know, arrangement where I can accrue as much as possible. Well, that's basically what a corporation fundamentally is. And that's why corporations dominate. Like, of the 100 largest economies in the world, 51 are corporations. So there, it's advantageous to be selfish. In the case of a participatory economy, if you're selfish, in the case of a balanced job complex or remuneration, if you're getting more, you're doing that by basically social means. You're doing it by means that we hope are fair, that we hope lead to empowerment not only of yourself, or if you wanted to say accrue an advantage that you would gain to yourself. The idea would be that advantage would also accrue to others, precisely because there's no particular way in which you could gain as a result of that. At least that's the hope.
We should add one point. It's not a matter of being selfish or not selfish to get one thing or the other. The matter is of being selfish in the sense of the whole thing that we call being in tune with the universe. We have to be selfish by seeing that we have to preserve the sea because we want to see the fish or eat the fish. If we are selfish in such a small way that we don't throw paper away or we don't, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about understanding our place in the world, in the universe. We have to come out of the cocoon that we are sitting on. I mean, society has to.
That's a nice ending, but we got to thank you all.
Yeah. Thanks for staying. Thanks for coming.
Thank you all.
Amazing. Well,
you too.
Thanks.
Well done.
I'm sorry, but you're